Hello, I'm Alex Linder, and welcome to Radio Estina for the 19th of March. It's a Wednesday, year of our Lord, 2008. We're going to discuss a few things today. I'm sorry I was late on the uptake. I was up all night and just woke up a few minutes ago. We're going to talk about banks. We're going to talk about gold. We're going to talk about STDs. We're going to talk about negresses. We're going to talk about fags. We're probably going to talk about Nazis a little bit also. There was a very strong, violent, upchucking-like reaction to, on the part of some, to the discussion we had last time of Nazis and homos taken from the pink swastika, an article relating to that which appeared in Culture Wars. Now, when I started the broadcast, I messed up all three aspects I had to control, but I think I've got them about right now, so we should have our sound levels about correct. And let's see here. We'll also play a little music. I'm not going to run too long today, probably about 2 hours. I'm going to go a little faster maybe than I normally do, probably play a little less music, but let's see what we have now. First thing we want to talk about here is banking. And what I want to read you is and discuss is an article by a guy over at Colorado Gold called Don Stott, and he's somewhat sympathetic to racialism because I believe he was personally attacked and beaten up by blacks when he used to run banks, he used to run ice cream business in Philadelphia, I gathered from reading through his entire archive. And as I said, he is at ColoradoGold.com. He's a dealer out of Colorado, obviously, and he sells for, I don't know, like gold's like 20 over spot. So let me pull up his spot and see what he's saying is the spot value of gold right now. Gold spot, $947, so wow, it must have fallen about $50, $60 in the last 24 hours, because I know it was like $1,034 was the highest I heard. And I'm not saying he's the best guy on the net or that he is the cheapest. I don't know. I don't know too much about it, but he has been recommended to me by people I know who are reliable, so you might call him and try if you're interested in that stuff. And, of course, this is an unpaid plug. I'm just giving you a heads up because I know there are people in the forum who are interested in getting into gold. And it's not really so much a way to make money as to protect your money, as the feds are hyperinflating. Why are they doing that? Well, because they can do it. And you have these rich people who are running these investment companies, and they've created new and innovative vehicles for repackaging and reselling debt coming out of mortgages. And when it all falls apart, this stuff is resold so many times, nobody even knows where the papers are. When it falls apart, do you think they're going to accept their losses and you know, sit back in their easy chairs and consider what in their character might have led to these losses? No, they're not going to do that. What they're going to go is run to their Jewish friend at the Fed, who's going to run the printing presses and inflate the currency and use the newly created money, the unearned money, to bail them out. And that's what we saw the other day as Bernanke, Jew Bernanke. The mainstream reports won't say that he's a Jew, and they won't tell you the people at Bear Stearns are Jews, and the people throughout Wall Street are mostly Jews. But they are, and that's crucial to know. They are stealing that purchasing power from you because that comes right out of your paycheck. You have to go to work 40 hours a week, earn a certain amount of money. You earned it. They didn't earn it. They just printed it and bailed out their friends. When they inflate the currency, that means that the price of everything goes up, but the money that you earn isn't going to go up. It's going to stay the same. So your dollars will purchase fewer goods, meaning you are worse off, and they have had the fun of speculating with your money. Or with their money, because this has been going on a long time, they lost it, but you're going to pay for it. That's how it has always worked. And that's why people have said if the American people understood what was actually going on in these financial houses, there would be a revolution before morning. It's just another way to steal the country from the people who earned it originally. America wasn't in debt 100 years ago. It was owned free and outright by whites. But where are we now? We're in a bad position. Colorado Gold, Stott has an archive of columns, and one of them I think was worth looking at is banking. He really explains banking the white way versus banking the Jewish way, although he doesn't put it like that. He doesn't go off on Jews. I don't know if he knows anything about Jews. I don't know the guy, but I know that he is... Many of his columns are, you might at first take them as nostalgia, but they're really not. I mean, just simply talking about the way things used to be and giving an accurate accounting of how things used to be and a factual description of how they used to be, that's not nostalgia. It may induce that. For those who are older than, say, you'd have to be older than me. You'd have to be basically older than, you would have to have been of age in, say, 1960, and I wasn't born till 66. So if you're of that age, his columns will definitely bring back memories. And they will show you, these are kind of first-hand accounts of how life used to be in what the Jews call the old bad ages, the dark ages, before civil rights. Civil rights was nothing but a communist takeover of America. It wasn't carried out the way it was in the Soviet Union with bloodshed and shooting. It was carried out instead through the law schools and through the control of the media and through the enforcement of the use of terms that discriminate against whites and their perceptions of reality, so that everything before that era becomes bad and ignoble, but in fact it was much better. And in fact, you can ask almost anyone you want whether America was better before 1965 or after, and they will, I don't think I've ever found anybody outside of a book of Jewish lies who has claimed it was it got better after 65. It didn't. The liberation of the Negroes, what did that result in? That resulted in tens of thousands of whites being murdered over the next few decades, and tens of thousands of white women being raped each year over the next few decades. That wasn't going on before 1965. Of course blacks were more violent, but whites had a way to deal with them. They segregated them in their own communities. Did that mean the blacks weren't free? No, they were free to do what anyone else could. But whites were also free to keep them out of white property. Now, let's look at what Don Stott says about banks, and this is excellent because he gives a description of what real banking is versus the system we have today, and he does it in very few words. And there have been a lot of very good articles written lately, and most of them are news pegged to the bailout of Bear Stearns, but a number of different people from Mike Whitney on the left and the people at Lou Rockwell, and these people who all see it the same way are now tending to come together. There's so that left and right don't mean quite so much. It's basically whether you're on the side of Wall Street and bailing out these Jewish oligarchs, or whether you're on the side of people who earn the money, who think we ought to have a sound currency. That's where the split is. And there have been many takes on the problem, and I posted links to many of these, the takes that I think are the better ones. And I posted them in a thread. Let me see here. This thread... the thread in which I posted this particular article by Stott is a thread by Miles, but Remnant had another one in which, and I will link this in our show notes. Okay, after every show is archived within hours of its completion, and I include in there links to all the matter we've discussed, so you can read most of these yourself. I'll include the links to Remnant's thread in which I posted the better articles, the better takes I've seen on the Bear Stearns bailout, but I posted this particular take I'm going to talk about in Miles' segment on buying gold. And let's go through this. It's pretty interesting, and I'm by no means an expert on banking. But I do know where to go to find the right kind of information. And one of the books you want to read is A Creature from Jekyll Island that discusses really the origins of the IRS and the Federal Reserve back in the first two decades, around 1913 of the 20th century. And anytime you have a central bank by, you know, as Jefferson said, by inflation and deflation, they can soak up all the goods of the land. So you have to be very careful to protect what you have and not get stuck holding a mass of wet toilet paper. That is Federal Reserve notes. And I'd posted earlier, maybe a week or so ago, an article about that actually appeared in the SPLC paper. Now you think, why would those hate-filled Southern pederast homosexual Jews care about Liberty dollars. That is some guy's private attempt to circulate silver money. Why would they care? Well, because they are one with Zog, with Zionist-controlled government. And Zog, you know, first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me, and that goddamn well applies to Zog's money. They can't stand competition, because real money will drive out the bad money, if people have a choice. But if they don't have a choice, then the bad money will drive out the good money. And so the Fed sent out a truck to round up this guy's, he's some German name, he has Liberty dollars, and they were starting to gain a little bit of a circulation. They busted him. I don't have that link in hand, but that shows you how the Feds feel about competition with their money. You have to take their Federal Reserve notes. So, getting to the article now, Don Stott says, this is March 17th, 2008 column. Just check my levels here. He says, banks are in reality a rather odd type of business. Originally, before paper money and checks, gold and silver were the monies in daily use. People who were wealthy needed a place to store their gold and silver, which was surplus, so they used a storage facility, which is what banks were. The banker charged for his services and gave you a receipt for the gold and silver placed in storage. To retrieve your gold or silver, it was only necessary to present your deposit receipt, and your gold and silver were returned to you. So at that point, banks were like a warehouse, an actual physical warehouse. Today, they're like a virtual warehouse, except the goods stored in the warehouse are there. They're loaned out to someone else. That's what fractional reserve banking is. They need only, by federal rule, keep a tiny, tiny, tiny portion of what you're thinking you have stored with them. But all you really have is not the physical gold and silver stored in the bank. You just have a marker in your own bank account. It says you have X, you know, number dollar claim on this bank. But the bank has reloaned that money. It's loaned at least, I don't know what the fraction is they have to keep, but I doubt it's more than 1 or 2%. It used to be about 10%. So that's how crazy it is. That's why people say that the only thing sustaining banks is people's faith. Because if any number of people showed up at the bank at the same time, if there was a bank run, they wouldn't be able to supply everybody with all the money that they claim is in these people's accounts. So a bank today is not like a warehouse, but banks did start out as warehouses. But in between the paper and the actual deposit is where a fraud can creep in. And you can see how cunning people like Jews would have realized what could be done if you can get away from the physical gold and the silver to notes representing claims on gold and silver to notes representing nothing but notes. There's a huge margin for cheating people and tricking them and rooking them. That's what happened, of course. So, Stott says, that's originally how it was done. People would put their gold and silver in a bank. They would get a receipt for the money that they deposited there, like you would, you know, at a coat check or something. And he says, this was the origin of the checking system. The bankers or storage units of their customers' gold and silver eventually discovered that only a very small number of depositors ever wanted the full amount of their gold and silver immediately, but left most of it in storage for safekeeping. The bankers thought that they could earn extra money if they loaned someone else's gold and silver and charged interest for its use. This decreased the storage fees charged, which was the legitimate way the banks were earning money. They say, look, pay me, you know, 1% annually and I'll store your gold and silver for you. So that's a legitimate fee in return for a service rendered. But it's not very sexy. It's not very exciting. They wanted to find new ways to make money, as banks always do. So why don't we take Joe's? Our studies show that he's probably not going to demand more than 15% of his money over the next year. Let's take, 80% of it, say, and loan it out to someone else at higher rate of interest. That's how we really make some money. So that's what bankers began to think. Excuse me. The banker loaned your gold and silver and paid you part of the fee he charged for its use. The banker made a profit, and you not only got free storage, but were paid to leave it there. Bankers then became loaning agents as well as storage agents. Bankers had to be very careful of who they loaned their depositors money to, or they might lose their customers' gold and silver if the loan went into default. This is pre-FDIC. They have no one backing them up. If they make bad loans, they go down and the bank closes, and they get sued by the people who left their deposits there, most likely. Bankers who were careless and who loaned to irresponsible borrowers or who loaned too much of their depositors' gold and silver went bankrupt and were jailed, sued, or had other actions taken against them. Good bankers were careful about who they loaned to, were careful about the security of their facility, and became pillars of their community. So far, so good. There have always been crooks and dishonest people in the world, so bankers had to be careful about fake deposit receipts, which would steal their customers' gold and silver, plus careless or dishonest employees who would do the same. He says, like any successful businessman, bankers who were successful wanted to branch out. They wanted to start new banks and make more profits. They then built new banks, hired new managers who they thought to be honest and reliable. He says, this is why I deal with a locally owned bank and whose owner I know personally and know of his honesty and ability. As bankers obtained more branches and spread out all across the nation, their operations became extremely complex compared to the old-fashioned banker, local banker, who everyone knew and trusted. Huge banks developed, such as Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and the like. Customers became a mere account number or an anonymous account holder who may be known by a familiar teller, but there was no contact or familiarity with management. The difference between buying groceries from a mom-and-pop grocery or meat market and from a huge supermarket chain might be a somewhat good parallel. The managers of these banks, which numbered in the hundreds or more branches, then hired loan officers and trusted making loans of depositors' money to that officer, who perhaps had poor judgment. Banks then began to sell stocks to raise money to do their expansion and build more buildings and hire more people and managers. Gone was the local banker, the pillar of his community, whom everyone trusted and admired. Banks became big business and were run by tens of thousands of employees, loan officers, cashiers, tellers, vice presidents, and other employees. With millions of shares outstanding, the shareholders wanted a return on their investment, so the banks worked hard to make as much profit as they could, so as to declare dividends to those who loaned them the money to become as big as they had become. Anyone see why this might not turn out too good? It didn't. So, essentially, it, like everything else, you know, it goes from small and local and known and trusted and careful to large, nationwide, anonymous, essentially, where people have no ties to their community but might be, you know, hired as a manager in Dallas and then sent to, you know, San Antonio or sent to Little Rock, Arkansas, and, you know, they have no connection. They're thinking of the return they can make and moving up themselves, and it's just a different kind of thing. And that seems to be a common theme in a lot of what we discuss at Radio Astina, is the taking away of power from the local area and the giving it over to the state or the feds in particular. We'll talk about homeschooling a little bit more just a little later, because there's an aspect of it I've been researching, and I have a little bit of information I've gained. I want to share it with you. That's what I want to do. I want to share it with you. But still have a little more of this column. He says, so what you have is basically the nationalization, even globalization of banks. You have anonymous account holders, and you've lost the connection between the managers of the bank and the local areas in which they operate. And at the same time, you have the banks putting out IPOs and taking in money from investors, and these investors want a return, and that in turn increases pressure on the banks to generate profits, and they do that by expanding their loans. And if they expand them too far, why, then you have what we have today. You have the origins of it. He says, banks with their maybe hundreds of branches had to show a huge profit to pay dividends to shareholders, as well as support a huge central headquarters, communication systems, and investment operations. In order to make all the money they could, some banks began charging for the use of a physical teller, or charge for cashing a check, or using an ATM. This didn't sit too well with customers, but foolish as most Americans are, they swallowed hard and stayed as a customer. Big banks, in order to show even more profits, became careless about their loan policies. They were so anxious to loan that they often got insufficient information about the borrower or the security the borrower presented to borrow. A man might come to a bank for a loan to buy a house, present an appraisal of the house, and give the banker his income. If the appraisal had been exaggerated by the appraiser because he had been bribed by the real estate salesman, who's looking for a commission, and the would-be borrower didn't have proof of his income, and then on top of that, the banker had loaned too much of his depositor's money out, can you now see what has happened? Some of this is not grammatical, but you get the basic idea. The idea is there's a lust for profit. So a lot of this really goes back. It's not even so much of a political problem as a moral problem. Everybody wants something for nothing. The banks want more profits than they need. The people want bigger houses than they can afford. The real estate people want higher commissions than they can honestly earn. The appraisers want more appraisal jobs than they can honestly come by. So everybody is combining to do immoral things that they think will profit them, but in the end, what happens? Well, pretty much the honest people are left holding the bag because the people who have the most power, who are at the top of the chain, just print money, thereby screwing the people who saved their money, didn't try to get a bigger loan or more housing than they could actually afford, and lived carefully. So maybe the moral of the story is immorality doesn't pay unless you're at the top of the food chain. And if you are, you can pretty much get away with it a lot of the time. Especially if your friends are fellow kikes who own printing presses. Anyway, he says, understand the following. A bank's loans are an asset on its books because the borrowers owe to the bank, and a deposit is a liability on the bank's books because the bank owes the depositor the money he deposited. Therefore, when a bank made huge loans, irresponsible loans, careless loans, or downright stupid loans, these loans showed up as assets on the bank's books, and everything looks just fine. He says, the largest investment banks are the ones in most trouble right now because they did all of the above. They loan too much for bad security and to poor risk borrowers. So they're more concerned with getting the loans on their books as an asset than they are in checking into, well, what does this clown actually intend to do with the money? Does he have a valid use for it? Does he have, you know, collateral? Is there anything we're going to get in the back end if he can't pay it? They didn't check on that because they were anxious to get these loans down. Banking success depends a great deal on faith. Faith that the bank has cared for your deposits and didn't loan them out haphazardly or irresponsibly. If word gets out that the bank may have made a lot of mistakes with the depositor's funds, they will come to the bank and attempt to draw out all their money, which is called a bank run, which is exactly what has happened to Bear Stearns and will probably happen to other investment banks. Will the scare carry over to commercial banks? Probably not, but I don't want any dollars in those huge chain banks. The bigger anything gets, the more inefficient it gets, as witness the federal government, Army, Navy, Air Force, and the D.C. gang in general. That's a good point. The Catholic principle is subsidiarity, where power is kept at the level at which it is most effectively used. And it is that principle that is at odds with Zog's principles of centralizing all substantial decisions. We ought to discuss that more at length later. Anyway, he says, depositors lined up at Bear Stearns demanding their money, and the tills were empty. The feds and other big banks then inserted $200 billion of your money to pay Bear Stearns depositors. But it was bought out for $2 a share over the weekend. As an indication of the trouble the world's financial system is in, the Fed cut interest rates by 0.25% on Sunday, a move which is unheard of. But it is an indication to me of deep trouble ahead. Bear Stearns made every mistake a bank could make. They invested poorly, loaned on real estate which wasn't worth what they loaned on it, and loaned to poor risks. A good bit of mortgage debt is sold to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who in turn have sold 40% of their mortgages to foreign banks. Now, hundreds of billions of debt has turned sour. No one wants to loan anything. Huge bank portfolios, in many cases, may not be worth the paper on which they are printed because the properties are in default and many times are being vandalized. So you have these houses that were overloaned on, and what you're seeing now is people just run away from them, and then they either get squatters in there or they slowly deteriorate. And if you look around your town and you see houses that this has happened to, you'll see that they don't really deteriorate slowly. They deteriorate pretty damn quickly. If someone is not taking care of a house, it will go downhill rapidly, even at, you know, without graffiti and vandalism. Nature takes stuff over at a remarkable clip. As you've known, if you've ever taken a garden and not weeded it for a couple of weeks, you come back, you're like, oh my God, what is going on here? The people who think nature is weak are wrong. As if that weren't bad enough, a recent court case denied a foreclosed property to a lending institution which was way down the line because they could not produce the original mortgage papers. They had bought paper from someone who had bought it from someone who had bought it from someone who had bought it from someone, and who knew where the original papers were. My small local bank has had one foreclosure, and they sold it instantly. See, that's how it works in an honest market. The banks, it's always risky when you're loaning money. There's always a chance that even the best-looking proposition will go bad, and the debtor will go into default, and then you're left with property. Now, banks aren't in the business of managing property. But if they have a lot of people defaulting on loans, then they suddenly, you know, leave the keys in the mailbox and head out the door, hopefully without trashing the house, although many times they do. I mean, what's the bank going to do? It's got a problem. It wanted a loan, an asset on its books where it was being paid regularly and making predictable profits. Now it has a house that's degenerating in value, and it's got to come up with some solution. Now, even the best banks are going to have a certain percentage of defaults on their loans, but if they've been making careful loans, they're going to be able to handle that minority of defaults. So as he says, his bank, operated by a local guy who he knows and trusts, has had one foreclosure, and they sold it right away. That's how banking is supposed to work. He says, compare that to a huge mega bank chain with hundreds of branches and hundreds of managers and loan officers, many of whom are inexperienced, or who are trying to make a name for themselves by making loans which never should have made, but were an asset on the bank books. Those are the subprime loans. Loans that almost by definition are made to people who are not loan-worthy, not credit-worthy. And again, just as we see in every other area of American life, the abandonment of standards and the presenting of that as though it's some kind of moral, oh, you're putting people who couldn't afford it into houses. Well, if they're either credit-worthy or they're not. Just as Negroes and Mexicans are either educable or they're not. If they're not educable, it doesn't matter what you try to teach them or how good you try to make them feel about themselves. They're not going to rise up and meet the standards that humans can meet, that whites can meet. And there's always going to be a gap, and white racism has nothing to do with it. And so it is in this. You know, we have the Jews running our country, and too often when institutions practice responsible loan making, the Jewish regulators will show up, or departments run by Jews will show up and claim that they're redlining. They'll say, well, you're not making enough loans to minority areas. So they go in and they force them, and in tandem with the pressure supplied by the Jew-owned newspapers, they force them to make bad loans at preferable rates to incompetent Negroes and other minorities. And then when these niggers and Mexicans default on the loan, why, they turn around and they bash the bank again. So either way, you can't win in a Jude system. You are always responsible, and the minorities who serve as tools to the Jew are never responsible for anything. You're forced to make them bad loans, and then you're guilty when the loans go bad, as they predictably do. That's how it works when whites allow Jews to take over their countries. He says, now he doesn't go into any of this. This is purely me explaining to you a little extra, the ethnic angle of subprime loans. But his point is that these are large national chains. They're packaging these mortgages and they're reselling them, you know, 15 times to where you can't even locate the original papers. So how the heck do you know what's going on? And the irony of this is that Bernanke, the kike who runs the Fed, I saw a good quote from him yesterday. I don't have it at hand, but in 2003 at a conference, he was saying that precisely this type of new, these new packaged loan vehicles were great for diversifying and managing and protecting against risk. These things which have now brought down the system almost. He was praising a scant 5 years ago. So, above all, the kike seeks to exculpate the kike and protect its kikely brethren. Consider the fake appraisers who exaggerated appraisals and were bribed by hungry realtors, anxious to make sales. It has all come home to rest, just as I have been writing about for years. Real estate has become foul, just as did the dot-com stocks and NASDAQ. Millions will lose. Correction, everyone will lose. Why? Because the DC gang probably will try to print its way out of the mess, as it has already done with Bear Stearns, and did a few years ago with another private investment fund, LTCM. That was long-term capital management. That was a couple of, just to very briefly digress, it was a couple of Nobel Prize-winning economists from some big Northeastern university. And, of course, brains like that ought to be able to make a huge success in the gambling market, you know, called the stock market, called loans, real estate, whatever. Well, no, they went bankrupt. They blew, like, over $1 billion worth of capital, proving that the ivory tower really is an ivory tower. You know, speculating is one thing. And dealing in money is one thing, and I recommend it because it more than school and more than religion will teach you how to think, because it will show you precisely what your opinion is worth. It's an honest form of speculation will, but it's not easy, and that's why it's valuable. But these academic clowns, and I don't remember their name, but this was a big story a few years ago at Long Term Capital Management. They got in the game, and they went bust to the tune of over $1 billion. So you have to think very carefully about any of this, taking loans or making loans. And he's just talking a little more about the corruption of real estate. But anyway, he says, or LTCM, he says, they said, it's too big to fail. That's LTCM, long-term capital management. It might collapse the whole economy. Bear Stearns is a $400 billion bank, and we can't let it fail. Bear Stearns is the fifth largest investment bank in the world, and the stock value went from over $20 billion to $240 million almost overnight, so it went down by 90% of its value. The depositors will be made good, but the stockholders have lost many billions. Making depositors good is done with a printing press. That is, the Fed prints money and turns it over to Bear Stearns to fulfill its obligations it can't meet to its depositors. Will they also pay layman depositors when they line up, or another investment bank? We all will pay, because the bailouts will be just another Iraq or Afghanistan, and the presses will roll, making our dollars decrease in value. Our gold and silver be the same gold and silver, but cost more in dollars. And that's another thing. We have this outrageous, ridiculous, evil, immoral foreign war going on that's costing us, I don't know what a day, but probably $1 billion a day. Not far from it, possibly more than that. At the same time, we're bailing out these banks, we're bankrolling these foreign wars. Who benefits from all this? It's not you, the average white person. It's the Jew at the top of the system. Until we get rid of the Jews running the country, none of this will change. It will just get worse along predictable lines. He says, Stott says, locally, Russell Stover has a candy factory. Remember, he's somewhere in Colorado. Up in the mountains. They just laid off a third of their labor force. People are so broke they simply aren't buying much candy. They need to fill their gas tanks so they can go to work. In Iowa, Blue Bunny, one of the world's largest ice cream makers, is in trouble and is either cutting wages or threatening to hire Mexicans at lower wages. People are buying gas to get to work. They aren't buying as much ice cream. Auto sales are way down, as are restaurant sales, resulting in layoffs. People have to make mortgage payments and buy staples to feed their families. The more that get laid off, the less they will buy, because they can't afford to buy. Without people buying, even more will be laid off, and the process feeds on itself. The Fed will probably lower its interest rate by another another. The Fed will probably lower its interest rate by another 0.75% later this week, or maybe more, but this will not solve the problem, only make the debt harder to sell overseas. Watching Secretary Paulson on Fox News Sunday, I was appalled at his failure to answer questions about other banks being in trouble. He sounded like a stuck needle on a worn-out record. The economy is sound. The economy is sound. The economy is sound. And we'll do what it takes. We'll do what it takes. We'll do what it takes. Oh yeah, not in my books, fella. All they can do is print, and that's simply hurting everyone. And when the Dow goes down, crosses the price of gold going up, and it will happen, the rush for gold and silver will be astronomical, far outstripping supply. Know what will happen to the dollar price of gold and silver then? You figure. Protect yourself. Now, of course, he's a gold and silver dealer, so he's saying that, and you could look at him and say, well, if you know that's going to happen, then why are you selling the stuff instead of buying the stuff? That's a question, but that they'll continue to inflate the money supply is predictable. That gold will probably at least maintain itself over the next year is probably also predictable. Will it go wildly up? Who knows? I certainly don't. Anyway, that's a good grounding in the basics of banking, which is that I'd take more of an E. Michael Jones approach on it, though. I'd have never seen him write about banking, but I know he would trace it back to a moral flaw, and that's really what you see. You know, desire for excessive profits leads to immoral behavior that brings the roof down on everybody, even the Jews at the top. They get into a real, real game, and it can turn out a lot of different ways. Turned out in Germany to lead to the rise of the Nazis. The Nazis were kind of treading water until the hyperinflation in Weimar. That helped them a lot. The excessive demands that the Germans pay money to the English and the French and the pressure from the East. Now, we'll take a brief music break and then we'll come back and we'll talk a little more about we'll talk about STDs and blacks. I think that's interesting. Now let me see. I don't have it queued up here, but we'll play. We'll start with a track, Stevens. The heart, heart, heart.
I'm looking for a hard-headed woman, one who'll take me for myself. And if I find my hard-headed woman, I won't need nobody else. No, no, no. I'm looking for a hard-headed woman, headed woman, one who'll make me do my best. And if I find my hard-headed woman, I know the rest of my life will be blessed. Yes, 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 yes. I know a lot of fancy dancers, people who can glide you on the floor. Oh, oh. They move so smooth but have no answer. Oh, oh, oh. When you ask what you come here for, I don't know why. Thank you. hard-headed woman, headed woman, one who will make me do my best. And if I find my hard-headed woman,
that was Cat Stevens and Hard-Headed Woman. We're going to listen to one more song, and then we're going to come back to the discussion. This next will be Ashamed by The Tick, the Deer Tick.
I am the boy your mother wanted you to meet, but I am broken and torn with heels at my feet. And with your purest life, why don't you shine on me? Well, I should have been an angel, but I'm too dumb to speak. Now as she gets near, the visions get clear. I'll kneel and weep, and I will hold her dear. Oh, if your eyes water, you got your favorite number to spend. And we became murdered, my throat screaming bloody all night. Hit him with the book and how he crumbles. Oh, you should have seen how the arches tumble. They're golden no more, now I'm smiling in my blood. I'm caught in a whirlwind, I'm going to heaven. I'm standing on trial and it's painted on canvas, an eternal testament to how we are so animalistic. And
isn't that a nice little song? That checks in at mere 2 minutes and 15 seconds. And if we have any songwriters out there, I highly recommend you write short songs. Most songs go on too long. 4 minutes is too long for most songs. Good length for a song is about, I would say, 2 minutes to 2:45. If you have something to say, it can be said that quickly, that condensed. And I think that guy behind Deer Tick, it's basically a guy named John McCauley, I believe. Anyway, they have a couple of good songs. I'll play that one a few more times. I have some other songs lined up. We'll play them a little bit later. Nothing too particularly new. Maybe one new one you haven't heard before. But right now we want to talk a little bit about STDs, venereal disease, and some of the recent studies that have come out and what they imply for the people trying to run this country. Let's see. We'll talk about the teen one in a minute, but one study that came out in early March was reported by Reuters and other sources. The U.S. syphilis rate rose for the 7th straight year in 2007, driven by a continued surge in cases among homosexual and bisexual men, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said on Wednesday. Those are the suckers down in Atlanta. Let's see, so it's up, the rate of syphilis is up 76% since 2000. And it says that homos and bisexual men accounted for 64% of syphilis cases in 2007, up from about 5% in 1999. And let's see, it says They also called rises among women and blacks. Boy, how they love to put those together. Troubling. The overall national rate of syphilis rose by 12% in 2007 from 2006, reaching 3.7 cases per 100,000 people. That's not a huge amount, but look at where all of these STDs are more prevalent among fags and niggers and Mexicans. And yet we are told that diversity is our greatest strength. Well, mixing in a stable, homogenous white population of the type of people that Don Stott from our last segment writes about with these diseased, ignorant, violent peons is in no way a strength, and in every way a weakness. But the meta problem is that we allow Jews to take over our sense organs, our media, and our government, that is, and repeat these lies ad infinitum and destroy our next generation. We should be like ants in a kicked over colony who are scurrying to grab the eggs and run and protect them. Instead, we are turning our people, our youngest, most vulnerable representatives of our species over to these Jews for brainwashing in the public schools. And in the public schools, they're taught that race doesn't matter, it doesn't exist. Oh, and whites are guilty. They're guilty for slavery. And they must ever, forever do penance and allow themselves to be discriminated against because of that. And that empowers these disease-ridden idiots we know as niggers. Ultimately, this is genocidal. It's not something that goes up and down. I've said this many, many times. It's not something that goes up and down. It only goes one way. And you can see what lies down the track, ultimately in Zimbabwe, where there are practically no whites, and the niggers left to their own devices are starving to death because they simply don't have the IQ points to run a farm and feed themselves. And a stopping point along the way between here and there is South Africa, where 30,000 whites have been murdered since political rule was turned over to the blacks, courtesy of the offices of the international Jew-controlled media and the corrupt leaders that the whites had chosen, who in time gave in to pressure. Never give in to pressure. Don't give in to the Jews. Fight the Jews. If you know that someone's a Jew, that's good enough. They're your enemy. They must be resisted, fought, and defeated so that we can live as we are among our own kind. Otherwise, you get article after article, and next year they'll be reporting the same thing. Well, what's another group that Jews promote heavily? Fags. Well, what's remarkable about fags other than they're being psychologically disturbed? Well, they have diseases at far higher rate than ordinary people do. Why is that? Well, they're psychologically fucked up, and one form that takes is their great desire for anonymous sex. We saw in the one study I've mentioned before from Australia, it found that 28% of male homosexuals had had more than 500 partners. I don't know about you, but I don't think I've met 500 people I'd want to be in the same room with, let alone have sex with. But fags don't look at it that way. They don't live that way. And so fags and niggers are spreading syphilis, yet when you turn to any mass media production, what do you get? Oh, fags are wonderful interior decorators. They'll teach you how to dress and how to dress up your house and how to do your hair. They're your wife's best friend. They're perfectly normal. Just look at Will and Grace. They're such delightful, witty people. They never show you what fags and niggers actually do, what they're actually like, and there are things you want to stay far away from. And there was another study that came out, and this was a study of teen girls, and it found that although there's no meta-interpretation given to it by the press, of course, which just reports the facts in a rather boring manner. It says a quarter of U.S. teen girls have sex-related disease. Well, what are most teen girls? What are their sources of influence? public schools and their peers in those public schools and TV. And what's the number one watch channel by young girls and then older girls? Well, it's Nickelodeon and it's MTV. Both are owned by the Jew named Sumner Redstone. Both promote race mixing and the ridiculous philosophy of girl empowerment. How do girls empower themselves? Well, they do it by corporate rebellious things like getting tattoos and piercings, listening to stupid music that Jews produce, buying alcohol produced by Jew-owned companies, and being sluts. And being sluts in particular with niggers or some other ethnic minority to prove how cool they are and how far from their racist roots they've come. And all the popular culture is geared to promote that kind of behavior. And so here's the morning after. The morning after, even into the Jewish media it creeps, although it won't spin it the way I have. It won't put it, and it, spin is not even the right word. Spin is the Jewish word for putting things in the proper context, which is what we do here at Radio Astina. The proper context is you have these surges in diseases among blacks because that's the way they are. They've always been like that. But among whites, you have it because they've been induced into that kind of behavior. They've been enticed into it. And enticement is a criminal charge. They've been enticed into the wrong behavior, behavior that the Jews know will be destructive to them, by our racial enemy, the Jews' use of television and other forms of mass propaganda, such as the slave camps known as public schools, in which precisely the same dogmas are taught in the public school churches as appear over the airwaves through Sumner Redstone's MTV, Murray Rothstein's MTV, and Nickelodeon. They are leading your child to destruction. They are putting dangerous things in his head. They are telling him lies. As they say in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, we knowingly feed the goyim false doctrines. We teach them doctrines we know to be false. Diversity is our greatest strength. What do you think they're talking about? Exactly that. Whether the book is fiction, whether the book is nonfiction, or whether it's, as the Jews claim, a forgery, which means it's pretending to be a document that it actually isn't that document, but there was a document that it's forged from. Nevertheless, it gets to the heart of how the Jews think and how they operate. We knowingly teach them false doctrines, doctrines we know to be false. Diversity is our greatest strength. Go mix with a nigger. That's why we put the nigger next to the blonde girl in every advertising paper you see and on TV. And we make the white male out to be goofy and stupid to better trick the marginal white girl into coupling with a nigger. And what happens? Well, she comes away with syphilis or gonorrhea or chlamydia or some other thing that she has to get cured of, if it, she can be cured of it. And what a lot of these girls don't realize is that even these diseases that can be cured can so scar your internal organs that you're unable to reproduce. And of course, you may think you don't want kids, but later on you may decide that you do want children, and then it could be too late. That's the part they don't tell you about, the risk that you expose yourself to when you're promiscuous. So this report put out by Reuters says, more than one in four U.S. teen girls is infected with at least one sexually transmitted disease, and the rate is highest among blacks. Now, remember, blacks and whites are not the same thing. Blacks mature sexually earlier because they're a cheaper form of life. The better forms of life take longer to mature. They're more refined. They generally have less babies. There are a couple of different evolutionary strategies that different species pursue. I believe they're called K&R. The biologist or whoever have named them. And the one is where you have millions of babies and you put very little parental investment into them. And that's what, like, bass or frogs do. You know, they have a bunch of eggs and they spray a bunch sperm over them, whatever the fish sperm name is. And, you know, most of the eggs are lost, but enough survive for the next generation. That's kind of how niggers are. They have all kinds of babies. They don't form families. They don't marry. They've never done that. The only time they did that was under white tutelage, under slavery. They would form marriages and stable families because they didn't have so many other options. But once slavery was done with, and once Jim Crow was done away with, and once the so-called civil rights laws were put in place, why, black bastardy vastly expanded. The black population went back to its natural ways, which is just reproducing at random and never marrying or forming families. They're not white, after all. That's what they do. The black has a kid and moves on, and then he has a kid with some other woman. And you get, you know, I forget the player for the Denver Broncos. Some nigger has, you know, he has 9 kids by 9 different women. That's how blacks have always done it. That's how they still do it in Africa today. They're not like whites. They can be forced to meet white standards with regard to reproduction to some extent if whites wield the whip, but suffice it to say, that is not the situation as it exists today. Whites have no power. Jews have all the power. And so niggers run rampant. And the important thing is that their generations grow and grow and grow. They're larger each year. They may make up a smaller percentage of the whole population because the borders with Mexico have been opened, and Mexicans have surpassed blacks in absolute numbers, but still, each generation of niggers is considerably larger than the last. And these are just masses of destructive animals. They're not productive or useful people. They're just absolutely destructive, dangerous, violent, stupid, and highly reproductive people. We had that one story about that gangbanger. I can't even remember his name. He was 25. He'd already had like 9 bastards when he was shot down in the street. By the time he was 25... How are whites going to compete with that? They'll be drowned out by that when they're having 1.2 or, you know, at best 2 children per family. Whites have follow a high investment parental strategy. That's, I think, the K strategy. And that is you have fewer offspring, but you put more effort and money into them. So whites are a more refined, better species, and they must be aware that the simple demographic power of the inferior species not drive them out. They must control their own future. And that starts by controlling your own government. And that means taking it away from the Jews who control it now. An estimated 3.2 million U.S. girls ages 14 and 19, about 26% of that age group, have a sexually transmitted infection such as the human papillomavirus, or HPV, chlamydia, genital herpes, or trichomoniasis, the CDC said. So, again, HPV, herpes, are not curable. I don't know that they're ultimately destructive, but they don't have a cure for herpes. They don't have a cure for HPV, which most people have never even heard of. And some believe is a precursor to, it can lead to higher rates of risk for uterine cancer. Chlamydia and trichomoniasis, or trich, can be cured with, antibiotics. But like I said, I don't know about trich, but chlamydia at least, or gonorrhea, these can scar your tubes, girls. And they can prevent you from having children if you want to later. That's one of the hidden dangers. Oh, you get a pill, get some penicillin, whatever, it clears up. Yeah, but there is a greater risk factor than is apparent. 48% of black teenage girls were infected compared to 20% of whites and 20% of Mexican-American girls. Now, that's remarkable. 1 in 2 niggers, teenage niggers, has an STD. So if you fuck a nigger, you're pretty damn likely to contract an STD, is the bottom line. And yet, the Jews who control the advertising agencies and the TV channels and the big newspapers are encouraging us, and through the government, are encouraging us to mix with this population that is highly disease-ridden. Feel like we're captives and our nation has been taken over by our enemy? You think they run diversity ads in Jewish publications encouraging Jewish girls to go out there and mix with niggers? Hell no, they don't. All that propaganda is aimed at white girls, at blondes, the Aryans who the Jews have always hated. They've been the traditional enemy of mankind, the Jews have. For thousands of years, they've been known as hostile and hateful towards all the rest of mankind, as Tacitus observed of them, the Roman historian. What we found is alarming, said the CDC's Dr. Sarah Forehand, who led the study. This means that far too many young women are at risk for serious health effects of untreated STDs, including infertility and cervical cancer. And you got to remember, these niggers and Mexicans have very low IQs compared to whites. So a lot of them, and a lot of these diseases don't have immediate symptoms. So left untreated, they're going to grow worse in them. And they're so fucking dumb, they don't even know enough to go to the doctor if they have a problem. So that, if you're going to mix races and you're going to have sex with non-whites, that's the kind of thing you're putting yourself in for, kind of risk. The very, very high risk, low return, having interracial sex. And, of course, the CDC isn't moralizing about this stuff. They're not going to tell you this, but basically the idea here is that you draw is that teenage girls of any race are risky to have sex with, but minorities in particular are dangerous. And you can believe the rates of the whites would be far lower if they weren't encouraged in promiscuity by the Jew-controlled media. And I don't mean simply the MTV. I mean every single piece of mass media that you come across encourages this, whether it's your local paper running garbage about MLK and having, you know, a little essay contest where all the little kids write about what here is. That's the same thing. That's encouraging people to think that blacks are these great heroes and nature's noblemen, and we shouldn't look at them any differently than we look at whites, but there's many reasons we should look at them differently. They're not the same. They're stupid, violent, disease-ridden animals. The CDC doctor can't say that, but the data do say that. The data she produced in a report say exactly that. Dr. John Douglas, director of the CDC's Division of STD Prevention, said a complex mix of factors is to blame for the higher rates among black girls, including the overall higher presence of STDs or in the broader black community. Therefore, for any given sex act with a given partner, a person who's not infected has a greater risk of coming into contact. Yeah, see, they try to make it all scientific and camouflage the data, but what it means is don't have sex with niggers. You want to avoid an STD? Don't have sex with niggers. That's an obvious start. Don't have sex with homosexuals and don't have sex with niggers because they're almost surely going to have one. But, of course, what the STD won't tell you, as the CDC being part of the, part of Zog itself, is they're not going to explain the social milieu in which all this arose. They can't get to the ultimate facts of how blacks and whites are not the same. So they have to account for this remarkable disparity in STDs by some socioeconomic factor or some cultural legacy, which will always ultimately turn out to be white racism. Why do blacks have higher STDs percentages than whites? Because of white racism. Slavery destroyed the black... No, slavery was the only time when the black family was together. There weren't any black families in Africa. There's just clans of related people. The families that blacks had were under slavery. Slavery didn't destroy the black family. I mean, occasionally families were broken up and sold off, but generally that was not the case. The pressure put on blacks under slavery, pressure amounting to their being boarded and fed and forced to work, actually did them good. If you consider living by white civilized standards good. If you don't, then it wasn't good. And you like what you see in the black community now, which is basically a bunch of chickens running around without a head because blacks simply don't have the IQ to allow them to operate as civilized beings. They require very strict, stern, strong, close management to be able to approximate the lower 10% of the white community. That's simply a fact. To pretend that these are our equals, well, they're trying that in South Africa, where 11 out of every 12 people are black. Maybe it's 12 out of 13 are black. Blacks run the country. They have black economic empowerment is their term for affirmative action. Whites can't get a job over there. What goes on there? Well, 30,000 whites have been killed since 1994. 15 years, 30,000 whites killed. Not a peep about it in the media in America because Jews control it. They like seeing whites raped and murdered. You think I'm exaggerating when I say stuff like that? You think that what I say springs out of hatred of Jews? That hatred of Jews is the cause rather than the effect of observing what Jews have done? If you do, you're wrong. I had no particular feeling about Jews until I saw what they like to do to all non-Jews and saw how they used blacks to destroy white communities and saw how they lied about what they were doing and lied about their motives, always casting their schemes in this universal benevolent light when in fact they're intended to advance Jewish and Jewish alone interests against the white people who gracefully or, you know, graciously let them into this country and foolishly let them into this country for how they repaid us. You know, bankrupting our major banks, demanding the printing presses be run to bail them out when their schemes come a cropper, mixing blacks in with whites and destroying white community, destroying white education. There is nothing Jews have done that has resulted in good results for whites. Their entire record is negative. Jews are a massive collective negative. They are a curse on any nation who has them. Exactly the opposite of what they claim in the media. Oh, God blesses those who bless them. No, he doesn't. God curses those who help the Jews or who cower in fear of them. He curses them. He strips them of their manhood. He strips them of their nationhood. He genocides the people who help the Jews. Every Jewish holiday is a celebration of the mass murder of their enemies. Think about that. Every single holiday celebrates the mass murder of the enemies of the Jews. These are the most hateful people on earth. And they want you to mix with these STD-ridden minorities. Loxism is rampant. All right, I think that's enough about that. Point is, if you want to stay STD-free, the best way is to abstain from sex until you're married, and then stay loyal after you're married. And nothing will ever change that. Is that difficult? For many of us, it is. And if you're not going to live in that way, then what you're going to need to do is be careful. And if you think that a condom is going to make for safe sex, I mean, that's another ridiculous euphemism. Using a condom will not guarantee a damn thing. Also, I argue that using a condom is not sex. You're not having sex if you're fucking some plastic. My personal opinion. I don't visit it on anyone else. Let's see. All right, let's play another song and then let's come back and let's... I want to talk a little bit about homeschooling. There have been a couple of interesting things on that front. I dug up a little information on K-12. And then we will... Well, let's just leave it there. We'll talk a little bit about homeschooling when we come back. Right now, I'm going to play a song called Leaving You by Emily Loiseau. I guess that's how her name's pronounced. Then I'm going to play a song by Tully Craft and then Roisin Murphy, Night of the Dancing Flame. And we will we'll be back after that third song. Here we go. Leaving You by Emily Loiseau.
To see if she was to the bar quads made to be. Anthems written for the discontent, but the eyeliner is key. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The mixing of the back. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The mixing of the back. Hoods up, poetry from the cul-de-sacs. Laughed out, anarchy with a note attached. Blast beats, window seats in the photographs. Tattoo lyrics from the Teddy Boys are singing by the bomb and the bomb. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the back. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. Punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the bad. Hat pins and safety pins avoid the wood ice and the curves. You want your record on the radio, you better sweeten up that verse. Abbreviate with the longest names, you can bet that hearts will bleed. So the clever and nostalgic ones will sing them poems at breakneck speed. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the bad. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. The punks are writing love songs. They're mixing up the bad. Hoods up, poetry from the cul-de-sacs. Bats out, anarchy with a note attached. Last beats, window seats in the photographs.
Dancing fate, dance around the fire on the side of the dancing fate.
All right, that was Roisin Murphy, Night of the Dancing Flame. Before that, we heard The Punks Are Writing Love Songs by Tully Craft. And starting it off was Leaving You by Emily Loiseau, as I imagine it might be pronounced, but could be wrong. We'll play a few more to round out the show. Right now, I want to talk a little more about homeschooling. I just found something interesting here. I was Googling it. We'll talk a little about a column by Vin Soprinowitz that appeared in LouRockwell.com. But the main piece of this segment on homeschooling will be a little discussion of how the feds have tried to take it over. In keeping with our line we discussed earlier about banking, of collectivizing all these decisions at a central location, far removed from where the actual loans are made or where the actual education is taking place. Centralization is of power is not white. Decentralization is the highest political flower, and only whites are capable of it. It's unnatural to Jews, to blacks, and other minorities, because they can't trust anyone to make his own decisions. So that is why those who call me a Nazi may not be right. Now, this is a funny little thing that I just Googled up here, and I try to pay very close attention to small details, but I think they're telling details. Now, what we have here is a site I've never heard of before, Jossip, JOSSIP.com. And there's a very awkward picture of Will Smith and the actor and Tom Cruise. Now, you know that Tom Cruise, ever since his escapade jumping up and down on Oprah's couch, has been widely mocked, and he's mocked as a homosexual, he's mocked as this or that, but primarily the attack is on him because he's a Scientologist. Well, let me formulate my thought correctly. What I'm trying to express to you now is that anyone, no matter how rich and powerful and famous he is, if he crosses the lines, the party line, the Judeo-Communist party line, and introduces the agenda that the Judeo-Communists are pursuing, he will come in for, depending upon the degree to which he has committed a crime, so to speak, for increasing amounts of criticism, until he becomes ultimately a complete butt of ridicule, a la Michael Jackson. Now, I'm no fan of Will Smith or Tom Cruise or Scientology, but I pay attention to things and I look at them and I try to interpret them, and I know what the Jews are trying to do. And when I see that Tom Cruise denounces psychiatry, and as the mother of Tony Soprano says in The Sopranos, isn't that just a Jewish racket? It's hilarious. And it is. When I see that a big-name actor denounces that, I figure a few red flags go up at Big Jew Central. And they say, okay, loosen him up. You know, start making jokes about him in the late night, and all of a sudden, you know, they start making jokes about him. This is how you do it. If you want to smear someone or defame them or make them a laughingstock, why, you have the late-night show joke writers go after them. And in this way, they're able to make it sound like eating meat is dangerous for you. You know, a staple of Saturday Night Live, if you eat meat, you're going to get a heart attack. That is not true. But it's a meme spread through Jewish media. And the idea that psychiatry is good for you is spread everywhere. Well, who makes money off that? It's, as the woman said, it's a Jewish racket. Well, here's another aspect now that we're talking about homeschooling. This is something I literally did not know until the music when I was Googling. And this story says, and they start, you know, spreading rumors that he's gay, that he jumps up and down, you know, that it doesn't matter. What Jews do is attack someone from every angle. They throw whatever shit they can find and hope something sticks. They don't care if they're contradictory, that he's gay and yet he's too much in love with his wife and acting crazy. They don't care. They'll mock him. Well, why are they mocking him? Well, because he belongs to a religion that believes things that are against the Jewish agenda. Therefore, to the extent he pushes those things, he comes under the public eye and for ridicule. And all the masses of people who watch TV and believe what it says and accept it as the ultimate authority ridicule him in the same terms. And that's how the Jews preserve their power. Well, here's an interesting little fact in this two-paragraph article. For the record, when Will Smith donated, the black actor donated in 2004, $20,000 to HOPE, the Hollywood Education and Literacy Program, Scientology's literacy program that encourages homeschooling, that perks my ears up. He was not advocating any of Scientology's principles any more so than donating money to the Christian Children's Fund to save starving African children affirms your belief that Jesus is your Savior. It's just a coincidence, then, that since Smith made that donation, his children have been homeschooled. Interesting. I did not know that Scientology encourages not only the rejection of psychiatry, but the positive acceptance of homeschooling. Homeschooling is revolutionary, and in Cruz's own California, Cruz, I believe, is a basic white kid from New Jersey, but California, as we've seen in earlier shows of Radio Astina, we've seen that they have passed legislation forcing all textbooks and teachers to portray sex freaks of the type who are disease-ridden, as discussed in our last segment, positively. So all these 500 sex partner having STD-infected fags have to be portrayed positively as a group in California textbooks, leading the Christians to call for an even greater exodus than they already have made from public schools. And they have variously estimated 150 to 250,000 homeschooled kids that already exist, and they're trying to get 600,000 more to leave the public schools because of that kind of crazy thing. So, to the extent an actor helps them by lending his prestige to their cause, and he hasn't done that. I mean, he apparently is just simply part of has his own campaign within Scientology of promoting homeschooling. To the extent he does that, he's going to be mocked and ridiculed by the Jews, and that hidden connection will never be brought to light, save through the offices of this show. Because virtually no one else is going to think in those terms, but I will tell you that is exactly what's going on. Anyway, that's something we'll keep an eye on, because I had no idea that Scientology encouraged homeschooling. Nor did I have any idea that Todd Cruz had a fund that encouraged homeschooling. So, interesting, and that Will Smith is following that and homeschooling his own children. Very, very interesting and telling. Now, and I'll put the link to that little story up when I do the show notes at the end of the show, and we're going to run about probably another hour. Got up late, a little rushed today. And I may do a middle of the night one of these days. I may do another one later this week. But let's see. Now, the article that appeared in Lou Rockwell I want to talk about briefly because it brings up some good points. And then we'll get into the history of K-12 funding from the federal level. And we'll begin to flesh out our picture so that we completely understand what is going on with education in America. But first, the Vin Suprinowitz. I don't know if he's Polish or a Jew, but he was more of a big player 10, 20, 30 years ago than he is today, but he still writes articles. And title of his article, "To Train School Children in Loyalty to the State." Remember, we're discussing what is the essence of public schooling. Well, it's making little slaves for the state. Now, if the Jews run the state, they're going to teach your kid what they want. Do you see how it all fits together? The Jews indoctrinate your kids to mix with niggers because that fits their agenda. They don't care if it leads your kid to be really, really stupid. They don't care if it leads your kid to be really, really sick with social diseases because of premature sex. Anything that destroys white children is good for Jews, and good for Jews is all that our government cares about. Why the heck do you think that we're bailing out Jew-run concerns like Bear Stearns? Why the heck do you think are we running these crazy foreign wars that cost $1 billion a day? Well, it's good for the Jews. Who cares if it's bad for whites? Well, you have to identify as a white person. We are the ones who need to come together and create a nation that's good for us. And the Constitution, the rest of that, has nothing to do with it. That's just another way of misleading you from your racial interests, which must be predominant. Every other group knows that what's good for its group is all that matters. The blacks, the Mexicans, the Jews. What about whites? Do we think we can really take on all these people and not ultimately sink our boat? I mean, story after story, we give you evidence that areas are being destroyed, lives are being destroyed, because we are not a racial group who protects its own interests. We are, nature has left us remarkably individuated compared to these other races, who are basically more like animals, and they have a very limited and defined set of operations. They're just violent, stupid, and they fuck things. That's all what niggers are. You don't get any upside to them. There's no great feats of intellection or feats of scholarship or feats of business acumen. No, you just get niggers. They smoke blunts. They fuck anything that moves and a lot of things that don't move. And they sell drugs, and they don't really do anything beyond that. And that's what they do and have always done and will always do, no matter where they are in the world. Because it's race that matters, not place. Now, if we allow them among us, or we allow third parties to take over our country and sick them on us, then we're going to reap the kind of results we've been talking about today. And what we're going to discuss now is the use of the public schools to inculcate whites with these lies. And just understand the theoretically the nature of public schools. We've hit this 100 times, but Suprinowitz hits it pretty well in this article. He says, "Don't you love when a member of the ruling class slips up and admits to the peasants what they're really up to? For years I've called for the complete shutdown of America's massive archipelago of mandatory government youth propaganda camps." The defenders of this largest jobs program in history shriek and bellow that I must be against education, which is sort of like charging those who oppose slave galleries with being against ocean navigation. So there you go. You see, if you fight the NEA, you don't care about kids, or you hate education. The same shrieks from the same parasites. And when he says massive archipelago, he's deliberately making allusion to the Gulag Archipelago, which was also set up and run by Jews in the Soviet Union. Those were all the prison and labor camps there. Far worse than anything the Nazis did, resulting in the deaths of far more people. And decades spent under absolutely horrible conditions, you know, in the Arctic Circle, a lot of them. And he's comparing America's, making the analogy to America's public school district. Remember, every state in the Union has public schools. And this forms a vast army of, you know, apparatchiks. I mean, all these people are employed. They vote Democrat. They're employed by the teachers' unions. They fight to take more and more and more money away from whites, and they browbeat anyone who stands up to them as being against education or hating children. He says, "Read de Tocqueville for his amazement at the high level of literacy, including an ability to discuss complex political issues found among American working men of the 1830s, 20 years before Dewey and Mann launched today's government-run youth camps on the Prussian model in Massachusetts in 1852. Where do you think kindergarten comes from? It's German. Prussia was the first to set up these essentially factory schools that produce a mass uniform product that is obedient and docile and trained to follow orders. That model was brought over to America. And that is the model that our public schools are based on. Now, what the libertarian and conservative, like this guy I'm reading from, won't tell you is that although they're right about the origins of the system, the point is, who is running the system to what ends today? The system turns out a uniform product, but who is determining what product is produced? Well, it's the people at the Department of Education. That is to say, the people running the federal government. Who are they? Well, they're Jews. And that is why everything that you see in a textbook, no matter what state you go to, will be something that serves the Jewish agenda. All the novels that are read will further the Jewish agenda. So you'll read anti-apartheid novels or short stories written by Jewess Nadine Gordimer. If you're in an AP class, you'll read To Kill a Mockingbird that puts out the story of Southern liberals defending a black unjustly accused of raping a white woman. You'll never be taught, your kids will never be taught the fact. All this is to install guilt, instill guilt in them, inculcate guilt in white kids. Lies about the history to make them feel guilty and back off and continue to give niggers all these subsidies, even when the niggers do nothing with the money except lay around all day and smoking blunts and rioting. So, the point is the system used, you know, but it can be used by anybody, and it's being used by the Jews who run the government. Whether the techniques of it are German in origin or not is beside the point at this point, although it's interesting to know. That's why we spent time talking about it. He says, so, before public schooling in America, the people were remarkably well taught. There was plenty of education around and lots of literacy without there being any public schools around. Think about it. How can that be? If the lies of the NEA were true, then there wouldn't be any education out there because there weren't any public schools, and yet the opposite is the case. Public schools inhibit education, certainly as they're constructed today. The New York Times reported February 27th, says Suprinowitz, that fewer than half of American teenagers know when the Civil War was fought, and one in four believe Columbus sailed to the New World sometime after 1750. About a quarter of teenagers were unable to correctly identify Hitler as Germany's chancellor in World War II, instead identifying him in a multiple-choice test as a munitions maker or premier of Austria. Why is anyone surprised? The academic curriculum is the cover, the front. The real goal is not to ensure education, but rather to ensure against successive generations developing a cohesive philosophy of self-sufficiency, a code of ethics appropriate to a free people living under a government of limited powers. Now, this is pure libertarian dogma because they won't discuss the racial aspect of the government at all. It has to be a government of whites for whites. It's not something that can simply be abstracted and cleaned of race and stands true for all people at all times. No, niggers are incapable of self-government, and Jews are capable only of totalitarianism. The goal is to make sure successive generations are powerless to muster the historical and economic context, logic, and critical thinking skills necessary to see through the latest scheme to seize yet more of our wealth and use the loot to hire more bureaucrats to regulate yet another portion of our lives, our industry, our commerce. It's true as far as it goes. Then he refers to the decision by the judge Walter Krosky, which covers, you know, the second district in California, the L.A. and Southern California area, that said homeschooling teachers have to be as credentialed as public school teachers, which has led to the massive outcry. And there's been a very, very strong reaction to that nationwide. You can track through Google and through VNNforum.com and in our learning section, where I have a thread devoted to the ongoing battle between public schools and homeschoolers, because I believe homeschooling is a real revolution. Because people who can educate themselves, know where they come from and where they're going, and are part of a large family, they are capable and fit for self-government. And if they don't need public schools, there isn't anything else the public provides that they do need. And that is radical. And they are revolutionaries whether they perceive themselves that way or not. And the NEA knows that. And the Jews running the federal government know that. And they're very threatened by it. And the decision by one of their beholden judges, Krosky, down in California, is one of their first attempts to reclaim that power. And they have a number of means by which they wish to do that. Because, you see, they are paid. We'll get into this a little later. I'll leave it right now. Let's just go on. He says, and did Judge Krosky and his black-robed ruling-class pals say this was because the homeschoolers weren't doing as well at teaching, reading, writing, and arithmetic? Of course not. They couldn't say that because tests consistently show homeschool kids taught by parents without state certificates or licenses score 30 to 37 percentile points higher than their public school peers across all subjects. So why ban homeschooling if the academic results are better? Judge Krosky obligingly explained, A primary purpose of the educational system is to train school children in good citizenship, patriotism, and loyalty to the state and the nation as a means of protecting the public welfare. Imagine that. Loyalty to the state. Almost as if what they're running are, I don't know, mandatory government youth propaganda camps or something. That's exactly right. What it is that Judge Kroski and his pals are afraid that these homeschoolers will recognize this giant farce being played upon them, the theft of their liberties and their money, by these arrogant, parasitic fucks who are incapable of anything good, but capable of much evil. And so we have to force them into our camps where they're going to be taught to respect us and the wrong way of doing things rather than go their own way. We have the power. Let's use it. And here we have, again, in the Suprinowitz article, someone writes, referring to an author I've mentioned before, John Taylor Gatto, "Dear Mr. Suprinowitz, I wasn't always a homeschooler. I stumbled upon J.T. Gatto while researching school reform after dealing with my local school district and getting nowhere but Delphide and a slap letter. Delphide is a technique by which they suppress resistance to their change agenda. I read Gatto's Underground History. In fact, I was unable to put it down. It explained how it has been done, how Americans have been turned into stupid, apathetic, self-absorbed, toadying sheep. At this stage of the game, the social engineers no longer even pretend to educate. They socialize. They mold minds. They decide who will go to college and lead and who will dig ditches for the local business government or the national corporate state. After finishing that book, I had to get my kids out, pronto. I regret that they spent their most formative years in the government school gulag, learning to take orders and stand in line, raising their hands to go to the toilet. In fact, when I told my youngest daughter, starting third grade, that we would be homeschooling, she asked me if she would be allowed to go to the toilet whenever she wanted. I almost cried." So they're taught that basically they can't do anything on their own initiative. They have to look to an authority to allow them to do it. That's how the Jews want your kid raised, so that he won't know anything. He won't know the context of his own life, and that he won't be able to take any initiative and be self-sufficient. If you're self-sufficient, you're capable of self-government. You're self-sufficient, and you have self-control, and you have knowledge. You don't need Zog. Zog wants slaves and taxpayers who never question what it's doing. That's what the public schools are aimed to produce, and they are succeeding in producing that. It's merely the cover story that they're there to intellectually educate your child, to give them intellectual education. They're not. They're there to create pliable, docile, subservient slaves. And he goes on and on. Anyway, the key there is you want to read, look up John Taylor Gatto, G-A-T-T-O, and he is one of the, I have him listed on the Radio Estina thread because we discussed him, I mentioned him in an earlier Radio Estina, and he's one of these who's written the books, like Charlotte Isserbait's The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. He's written a book by, I think it uses the same title, Dumbing Down. May even be the whole title, but he's written The Underground History of American Education. He explains what, and I think some of this is even available online, if I recall. He explains the background and the origins of public schooling, and what it's really aimed to do and why it's succeeding rather than failing. And I have a listener here who writes, says, they hate the Mormons for that too. Self-sufficiency, rejection of the Judeo-Christian constructs. They mostly homeschool and are very insular and not inclusive with supporting each other's businesses. They're white, they have lots of kids, keep their money within while not buying into the pop culture. So again, what they want to do is, and the arrogance of these people is incredible, because all these homeschoolers are asking is to be let out of the system to teach their kids their own way, the way they see best, and yet they're not even trying to get their tax money back from this slave state. But it wants them all, body, soul, and wallet. And it's bent on resisting them. Now, I want to talk about, leaving the Suprinowitz article, I want to talk about the history of federal involvement in K-12 funding. because all of this, these public schools, this all has been done at the state level and the local level until the mid-60s, and that's when the Fed stepped in. And what they stepped in with was called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA. Before then, the feds really didn't have any, again, I'm not talking about colleges. I'm talking about K-12, kindergarten through senior year. The feds were not involved in that until 1965. That's when they got the nose of the camel under the tent, or the nose of the taper under the tent. Through, as I said, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act under Lyndon Johnson. And again, we talk about all the bad things that began in the 60s. We talk about the Judeo-Communist Revolution. This is part of it. The federalizing of education, and in the name of setting standards or raising standards, they're going to see to it that your kid is taught nothing but fag positive, Jew positive, black positive spins on history, and white negative spins. Fags are good, blacks are good, Jews are good, Jews are holy. Remember the Holocaust and keep it holy. And whites are bad. Whites are evil and racist. Whiteness needs to be abolished. When the feds control education, that's what's going to appear in the textbooks. Because the Jews run the Department of Education, and the lobbyists all come from Jew-approved minority groups, and white interest groups aren't allowed to exist by deliberate legal discrimination and double standard, so the whites have no one to represent them. Therefore, the whites become historically guilty in the textbooks. Their children become lied to pawns of the massive slave state. And every which way they turn, they get battered by a wave. They go to public school and have their bodies battered by niggers or Mexicans and their minds battered by Jews or the willing or unwilling or unwitting dupes of Jews, the education majors called teachers, who don't care a damn about intellectual education. They just want higher salaries for doing less work. And here's the important thing. So under LBJ, you get the first federal involvement in local education. And two-thirds of the money, of course this money all comes from white taxpayers, two-thirds of the money is spent on either retarded kids, which they call special needs kids, or it's spent on low income, for which you can substitute nigger and Mexicans. So federal money comes in 65, and two-thirds of it goes to either retards, i.e. the uneducable, well, two different forms of uneducable, uneducable whites and uneducable blacks and Mexicans. You know, so again, your money is being taken from you and used to subsidize the growth and progress of non-white groups. And at VNNforum.com, in the Learning Forum, on the thread called Public Schooling History and Aims, I posted something from the government itself. And if you hit the link and go to the government site, you can get all the graphs. But basically, they show the continual expansion of federal involvement in local education over the last 43 years, from 65 to 2008. And so right now, the way it works is that these public schools are funded in part by the local government, in part by the state government, and in part by the federal government. And, you know, as everything works in the press, you're good when you spend more money on something. So the more federal money that goes out to these schools, the better it is for the schools, and it shows how much they care. Of course, the media, being part of the government, just as these schools are, the government education media complex is how to think of it. They always reinforce the other's propaganda memes. So you show that you care about education by taking increasing amounts of money from white taxpayers, funneling it through the federal government, through the Jew-controlled federal government and Jew-controlled Department of Education, out to Jewish textbook writers, following guidelines written by Jews, and then you pump all this back into the classroom where your white kid is brainwashed and indoctrinated, not only to be a slave, but a slave who doesn't know anything of history, but knows the right attitude to take on any of the major political questions of the day, which is always black good, homo good, Jew good, white bad, every single time. Doesn't matter what state you go to. Agenda is set by national. Now, the way that they trick white parents into doing this is they talk about higher standards. And the ESEA that got the federal taper nose under the tent was reenacted and upgraded as the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. It was a reauthorization of the ESEA. So this is, you know, under Bush. No Child Left Behind. What does that mean? The only way to close the obsession of these people is with closing the racial gap in education. And since blacks are not educable, there's only one way to close the gap, and that is to fuck up white kids. So, the public schools have no incentive to do to your child what you would like done. That is to give him a genuine educational, intellectual education that draws out his talents and his ability in order that he may become self-sufficient and run his own life. They have no interest in doing that. And they don't do it. They are aware of what you want and what you actually need, and so they will lie about it and try to trick you with talk of higher standards. But the fact is they're unwilling to allow any competition with their own model. They really don't like people homeschooling. The only reason that homeschooling is legal now is because homeschoolers, being real revolutionaries and serious about what they're doing, form together in groups that then lobby these legislatures to get it passed that homeschooling be legalized when it was illegal in 45 out of 50 states as late as 1983. And it was their hard, concentrated work that got it legalized, got it decriminalized. And now they've had so much success over the succeeding 25 years in creating prodigies and success stories that they've drawn more than 2% of public school age children into the homeschooling ranks. And it continues to grow, I guess, 7 to 10% a year. It's very hard to say. The NEA is always doing better with the Homeschoolers Legal Defense Association in terms of the actual numbers, but it's clear that homeschooling has been growing rapidly for the reasons cited above. But I think as it gets to 4 or 5%, you'll see a much more strongly concentrated attack on homeschooling because it is such a radical revolutionary threat to the system. Just an interesting fact to throw out here. She says, total taxpayer investment in K-12 education in the United States for 2004-2005 school year is estimated to be $536 billion. So, $536 billion for K-12 a couple years ago. And in addition to the K-12 money, taxpayers will spend $373 billion for so-called higher education. That would be college stuff. So, total, you're looking at, you know, better than $900 billion on education a year, so-called. $536 billion. Let's see. In 2004 and 5, 83 cents out of every dollar spent on education is estimated to come from the state and local levels. 45% from state funds and 37% from local governments. So, see, this is the source of the fear of the people in California, the local school district, is that they're not only not going to have the bodies there to brainwash with NEA propaganda, but they're going to lose the X amount per day per student that they're paid by the state and perhaps also the local government. And the state government, at least, will have those funds left sitting there in their own account. And, of course, the state of California being bankrupt has plenty of other things to spend that money on. So, to a large extent, if homeschoolers aren't in public schools, the state of California doesn't care, at least until they become, you know, 50%. And then it starts to threaten the ideological underpinnings of it because you have to have most of the people being trained up in slave ways. But well before that point, the NEA will start to squeal because it's losing money in brainwashing subjects. So, you see the incentives at work there. But this, and again, this is from, that I'm quoting from, is from ed.gov, so this is the Department of Education, and what they say is, the federal share of K-12 spending has risen very quickly, particularly in recent years. In 1990 to 91, the federal share of total K-12 spending was 5.7%. Since that time, it has risen by more than one-third. It is now 8.3% of the total. So more and more, again, we see power and money flowing to Washington and away from the local areas. And with that money, when it comes back, are conditions that the states have to agree to. And who do you think those conditions favor? Well, they're written by Jews. Let's see what they say. Says there are no unfunded federal education mandates as there are with in other areas. Every federal education law is conditioned on a state or other grantee's decision to accept federal program funds. Federal education program requirements are not unfunded mandates because the conditions in federal law apply only when a state voluntarily chooses to accept federal funds. So they come with ties, but you can refute. You don't have to take the money, but if you do take the money, it comes with ties. Any state that does not want to abide by a federal program's requirements can simply choose not to accept the federal funds associated with that program. While most states choose to accept and use federal program funds, in the past, a few states have foregone funds for various reasons. And, you know, it's the same thing with, like, highways. They'll give you road money, but you have to follow certain laws that they want written. Same thing with state IDs. Let's see. The No Child Left Behind Act gives our schools and our country groundbreaking education reform based on stronger accountability for results, more flexibility for states and communities, an emphasis on proven education methods, and more options for parents. Passed with bipartisan support in Congress and signed by President Bush on January 8, 2002, the law represents the most comprehensive revision of federal education programs since the passage of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA, of 1965. So, Title I, the largest federal K-12 program, would provide over $13 billion to local districts to improve the academic achievement of children in high poverty schools. So, again, taking money from whites and turning it over to coloreds is a constant theme of our federal government. And, in fact, the largest portion of federal funds are spent, are wasted, trying to teach little stupid little nigglets and illegal Mexicans. And where do you think that money comes from? It doesn't come from them. It comes from you. So they take your money. They not only force your kid into public schools where he's taught things he doesn't believe in, against his own people and his own kind, but they also take your money and they use it to train up these niggers to hate you. I mean, this is something that is certainly a revolutionary precursor. Why do we have schools that don't teach our ways to our kids? Why do we tolerate any part of that? Why aren't we out burning down these public schools? Why aren't we out burning down MTV and Nickelodeon? Why aren't we out absolutely throttling and destroying these Jews who are teaching our kids all these lies? And here we go again. It's not just the little high-poverty niggers, but English language acquisition would provide $675.8 million to states to assist schools in improving the education of limited English-proficient children by teaching them English. So you have to pony up another $700 million to teach little Jose and Maria to speak English. You didn't want them here in the first place. They're not your problem. You have nothing to do with them. But they take money from you and give it to them for their benefit. I don't see any titles on there for exceptionally intelligent white youth. What about their special needs? Well, they don't figure in. Whites are just supposed to keep on doing what they do, and they'll keep taking more and more money from you and telling more and more lies about your kind of people, as long as Jews control the federal government. That's what will happen. You know, and again, this is all just pure minority pork. Other NCLB programs, No Child Left Behind programs, include those to support charter schools, strengthen high school education, improve math and science education, support after-school learning programs, and assist American Indian, Alaska Native, and migrant students. Now, again, they're everything is aimed at the defective, the nigger, the Mexican, the non-white, and against you. So, I think that's enough about homeschooling for now. We've covered it. We'll continue to cover it. But what we know now is that we understand the background and the purpose of public schools. They're to make docile, obedient workers for business and turn out self-hating patriotards, essentially. People who hate their own race and who have no understanding of history or the origins of their own country or kind and are trained to be obedient to authority. A mass uniform defective product. And you have to avoid that by teaching your kid yourself so that he doesn't turn into a little self-hating robot. We'll keep going back to that, though, over time because there's more to learn. And what we also know now after today is that the feds, when America was founded, there was no public education at all. It didn't come about until 1850. And it came about on a state and local level at that point using a model borrowed from Germany. And the federal government had no involvement in public schooling until 1965 under the ESEA Act, which was reenacted and upgraded or rechartered as the No Child Left Behind, which aids minorities and takes money from whites and essentially messes up white minds. We'll go back to that in the future. We'll play a couple songs now, and then we'll talk about, we'll continue our discussion of the homosexuals and the Nazis and some of the reaction to part one of that. We'll finish that up, and that will take another half hour. Probably a little longer because we're going to read a little bit there. Now, I'm going to start off by playing Black Dress. I'm not sure who that's by, but then we'll play probably two others.
I sit by my window, have held all your letters till my fingers were blue. I recall every moment like I'm pressing rewind. I got what I asked for. Now I'm losing my mind. Even when I was younger, I liked being alone. Felt awkward at parties. Didn't go to the prom. While the whole world was dancing and falling in love, I stayed home in my slippers, watching Harold and Maude. Took a dive. I loved you the first instant you looked into my eyes. Now my whole world is spinning. I'm not sleeping so well. If love's really the answer, why does it put us through hell?
That was Make Me Lonely Again by Amy Spies, whom we've heard before, and also Black Dress by J.O.J. Don't know what the origin of that is, but I'm going to hear one more, and then we're going to get back and talk about the Nazis, the fags, the Catholics, and the how we separate fact from fiction in history. First, we'll hear by a group we heard earlier, Deer Tick. We heard them playing Ashamed earlier. This is Nevada. That was Nevada by Dear Tick, preceded by Black Dress by J.O.J. and Make Me Lonely Again by Amy Spies. Now we're going to go on to the final part of today's show. And we're going to conclude our discussion of an article by Scott Lively that appeared in Culture Wars by E. Michael Jones. That's his magazine back in 1996. And this is a particularly dicey subject. It bothers a lot of Nazis and pro-Nazis, and some of them have written to me, and they point out that the Pink Triangle is co-authored by a Jew named Abrams, I believe, and that appears to be correct. And so, this show is called Radio Estina, and that means radio reality, or it deals with facts, not an ideology. So, I am not an expert on the Nazis. I'm not an expert on any segment of history. I'm not really an expert on anything except certain uses of words. I know how to use words to produce certain kinds of effects, and on that I'm a legitimate expert. In history, what I'm trying to say is you should look at what I say skeptically, as you should at everything that you read, and understand where it's coming from. And where this is coming from is an attempt to understand the Nazis. Why them? Because they fought back against a Jew-controlled government and took power away from it and rid their society of Jewish influence, largely. And how they did that is necessary for us to study, who would remove the Jews from American society for reasons discussed earlier in the show. And in understanding the people who succeeded in their battle with Jewry, at least for a time and in a space, we want to understand who were these Nazis, what type of people were they. We want to know everything we can about their background. The lens that this particular article places before our eyes reveals a dimension of Nazi background that I think is worth considering. That's why I'm talking about it. And that is the homosexual side. And essentially what they do, and in part one we discuss this, they portray the Nazis as the butch, essentially a faction of butch homosexuals, that is, hyper-masculine homosexuals who wanted to recreate Greek warrior cults in Germany, and who were very much against, you know, heteronormativity, and who were against the femme fags, the queer faction led by the Jew Magnus Hirschfeld, who more or less coined the term racism and certainly was the first to launch it as a public word through a book he wrote with that title. Magnus Hirschfeld set up an institute for the study of sex in Germany, and he argued for the removal of Code 175 that prevented homosexual or criminalized homosexual activity. Jew Hirschfeld argued against that for 30 years, from 1900 to 1930, until he finally fled before the taking power of the Nazis. And when they took power, they shut down his institute. So what we have here is a Catholic, I presume, Scott Lively, I don't know of his background, and a Jew who've written a book called The Pink Swastika, and they've documented this, the connection between these Nazis, the homosexuals, the rise of the gay rights movement in Germany, the involvement of the queers with the youth movement in Germany, and the adoption of ways of dressing and hand gestures and mental attitudes that would culminate in the Nazi party and the Nazi movement. Now, whether these connections are real or whether they are propaganda, you have to decide for yourself, understanding that your leader here is not really fit to draw complete conclusions, but is sifting through this and looking at it with an interested but critical eye, as are you. So don't assume anything that you hear is true unless I say it is true, and even then you should be suspicious. I don't make so many assertions. I understand. When I discuss homeschooling, I know exactly what I'm talking about. I know exactly where the hard ground is and where the quicksand is. On this, it's a little trickier. But what we have to say here is that while these, and what people have alerted me to through various emails, and indeed I've posted on the same link at vnnforum.com, if you go to vnnforum.com, go to our religion and history section, in there is a subforum called Nazis the Facts, and in there, in that subforum, is a thread on the Nazi policy toward homosexuals, and that's where all this material I'm going to read from and discuss today is located. And at the end of that thread, on page 2, probably, let's see, where is it? I'll read the letter I got, and this contains a link to a complete debunking of the pink swastika. I have not read this yet, so. But he says, Alex, I admire all the hard work you do at VNN, but you've really dropped the ball big time on this one, i.e. reading the pink swastika on Radio Estina. On other issues, you have clearly done loads of background research before presenting material. That's not really true. It's just certain things I know pretty thoroughly. In this case, you seem to have come across a book with a thesis that you like, and you're running with it before having checked its claims out in the least. It's not really true. I don't like the thesis. I think it's provocative. It's interesting. And I think there is some truth to it. It's very clear there is some truth to it. And as I said in the first show, the problem I have with it is that too many of its claims about the sexuality of certain of the Nazis appear to me to come from Jewish historians who are, to say the least, unreliable. They will throw, as we've seen, discussing Tom Cruise, they will throw any kind of shit at the Nazis they can in order to get it to stick, and they don't care if it's contradictory. They'll call them, you know, womanizers, and they'll call them homos in the same breath. That's how Jews are. Now, this guy who wrote me this, and I have not included his name because too often I get people coming back to me wanting me to remove their names, but he says, I have been a student of the Third Reich and its personalities for some 30-odd years now and can unreservedly state that pink swastika is one of the biggest cobbled-together loads of fertilizer to come down the pike in a long time. It is one lie, misstatement, and twisted fact after another. With that book. Of course, that's the beauty of such effrontery. To critique it takes an endless amount of time and labor. Little effort is involved in just throwing baseless charges around. Case in point, the authors cite the long discredited and completely baseless claim that Hitler was a male prostitute during his Vienna years. This was a lie cooked up by the communists in the late 20s as black propaganda against Hitler. To their credit, the gays themselves took the time to refute this puerile, trashy book. And then he gives a link, which I have included in this letter. This is in post 21. Of course, they did not do this out of any love for Adolf. It should hardly be surprising that at least some gay men will be attracted to organizations projecting a strong male image. But this does not mean that these are gay organizations. The authors of the pink swastika are merely playing the old call your enemy Nazis game. They have problems with gays, and so they smear them by calling them Nazis, a tactic we are all familiar with. Please drop this book from Radio Estina, which is supposed to be about the factual truth, right? And get on to more useful topics. All the best from the person. I am going to finish the discussion as I said I would, but the link that this man provides is to a complete debunking. I have not read it. But I am just naturally suspicious of any Jewish historian, and too many of the claims about the Nazi hierarchy, including men who are married with children, are simply asserted and not proved. And like I said, the thing that is interesting about the pink swastika is there are the article that appeared in Culture Wars that's taken from either taken from the book or, you know, it's the same material, same type of material, if not word for word. Presents hundreds of falsifiable claims. Falsifiable means it can be proven false. It means it's an either or. It means, you know, if Hitler was a prostitute in Vienna, okay, where's the documentation? That's a falsifiable claim. Either he was or he wasn't. Either the Viennese police records contain proof of that assertion or they don't. And if they don't, then it's a lie to claim that he was. And so I haven't seen any documentation of that. And that would seem to be a pretty good place to produce it. So we have to be very careful about what we accept about the Nazis, given that we know that they're lied about endlessly by Jews, and we know the why of their being lied about, which is that the Nazis hit upon a way of opposing the Jews that worked. And what matters in that regard is they were not conservatives. They didn't talk in codes. They specifically went after Jews and the culture and Judeo-Bolshevism, as they called it, that had produced communism and created misery in the Soviet Union and was attempting to do the same thing in Germany and supplied the decadent smut in Weimar. Another fellow writes, Alex, are you aware that Pink Swastika was co-authored by a Jew, Kevin Abrams? That in itself ought to make these claims suspect. But should they turn out to be true, that would be a good reason for white nationalists to distance themselves as much as possible from the Nazis. Teutonic warrior fag cults is not the sort of thing I want to be associated with. I would say me too. Then again, I've been called a Nazi. I've never called myself a Nazi. I'm interested in the Nazis and figuring out what they did, because if you go to calvin.edu and you read around their German propaganda archive and read the speech of Goebbels and of Hitler, you see that they dealt with the same problems we do today in very Peircean terms. That is, they dealt with them directly and without fear, whereas everything written by the controlled opposition known as the conservatives reeks of fear, reeks of hinting at problems, but never addressing them directly. Now, let's conclude the article, our discussion of the article, and I'll read from it. Remember, always be skeptical. And I'll emphasize that a little more in light of the listener comments. But I did say on show one, I mean, when you're having, you know, these assertions are being made by historians with, to me, very Jewish names, and you know they don't like Hitler, so there's a predisposition on their part to lie, you would have to guess. But let's see. We'll start with the Rome Purge, and we'll pick up from there. And there's not too awful much more, but there's some. Now, their assertion was that Rome was indoctrinated into homosexuality by a guy who set up the Schiljungen after World War I, and who they call a sadist, a homosexual, and a murderer. And Ernst Röhm became the head of the SA. The SA had 2.5 million men under arms, which was more than 100,000 under arms legally as the German army. So Röhm was a key figure, and they're saying, well, he was one of very few that Hitler addressed as Du. He knew him personally and was very familiar with him. Now, Röhm and a number of his buddies were killed in the Night of the Long Knives in 1934, a year after the Nazis took power, a year and a half after they took power, June 28th, 1934. And the assertion of these, the Jew Abrams and Lively, is that the upper ranks of the SA were virtually all homosexual, and that they more or less put Hitler forward as their demagogue because he was effective at it. And the irony is that they sold to regular Germans this vision of normal, wholesome morals, as opposed to the decadent Weimar morality of the Jews and the communist opposition, when in fact they were themselves dominated and essentially the products of this butch homosexual subculture. That's what's being asserted. Now, Lively says in the Rome Purge, the event in history most frequently cited as evidence of Nazi persecution of homosexuals is variously known as the Blood Purge, the Night of the Long Knives, and the Rome Purge. Stakely, S-T-E-A-K-L-E-Y, writes that the indisputable beginning of Nazi terror against homosexuals was marked by the murder of Ernst Röhm on June 28, 1934, the Night of the Long Knives. It was on that night, actually over an entire weekend, that Adolf Hitler's closest aides orchestrated the assassination of hundreds of his political enemies in one bloody sweep. Among the victims of this purge were Röhm and several of the top officers of the SA, the Sturmabteilung that Röhm headed, the private army. We have emphasized that the leadership of the SA was mostly, if not entirely, homosexual. Again, they have emphasized that, but they haven't documented it. They've simply asserted that these men, who in many cases have wives and children, are homosexuals. That's not good enough. It's a very Jewish way of doing history, and if Jones is printing this stuff that isn't true, it's a sign of the fear. Because I haven't found him lying in any other circumstance, or even really wrong about too many things, other than having his books filled with typos, if Jones is deliberately allowing lying material into his magazine and his book, it is because of the fear that he would feel that Nazism would be a valid alternative, or biological-based politics would be a valid, indeed superior alternative to his morality-based Catholic ideas. And he has even confronted that in his show when he's taken pains to distinguish my position, I mean specifically me and VNN's position, from his own Catholic position. And he quoted me saying, you know, the Nazis did more in 12 years to rid the world of this Jewish pestilence than the Catholic Church has done in 2,000 years. Now, the Catholic Church's position is that the problem with Jews is that they're unconverted Christians. They are captives of their rabbis. And if by love and brotherly affection we show them that we accept them and we lead them onto the path of the truth in which they accept Christ, why then they will come around and the world will be saved. That is entirely different from the so-called Nazi view or the racialist view, which is that Jews are a different subspecies of human. And they are at odds with whites for genetic reasons as well as cultural and historical reasons. And there's no way to reconcile them. We must simply fight and oppose them and dominate so that our kind runs our space. And that, in fact, is the correct way of looking at it. Obviously, I believe. Not being a Catholic. But not being a Nazi either. I mean, they just because someone calls you something doesn't mean you are. Just because fags or Catholics call Nazis fags doesn't mean they are fags. You have to produce a little more documentation than that. If you're going to say that Hitler was a prostitute, a male prostitute in Vienna, and you're going to claim that there are police records showing that, why aren't those records produced? Because they're not produced. Is this simply an attempt to defame Hitler? Because if anyone can be defamed without the need to back it up, it certainly would be Hitler. Michael Jackson would probably be number two, but Hitler would be number one. We have emphasized that the leadership of the SA was mostly, if not entirely, homosexual. The fact that SA leaders were the primary targets in the massacre could therefore be construed as a sort of moral cleansing of the Nazi ranks, which, in fact, Hitler claimed it was. But Hitler lied. The Rome Purge was driven by political, not moral concerns. Hitler feigned disgust and outrage about the homosexuality of the murdered SA leaders to justify himself to the German people. It was a tactic he had used previously to allay public suspicions about the sexual deviancy of his inner circle. The importance of this fact is asserted in many leading works by both mainstream and homosexualist historians. The following are excerpts from four different historians who have examined the issue. Hitler eliminated his closest friend Rome and certain SA leaders as potential rivals. The strictly political motivation of this ruthless power play was initially too obvious to be entirely denied, but later it was conveniently obscured by charges of homosexual depravity. Haberle. That's the first of four he's going to cite. The formal accusations against Rome and those arrested around with him centered on their homosexual activities, which Hitler had, of course, known about for 15 years and shrugged off, it being alleged that these activities disgraced the party. For those victims without any homosexual background, the Great Blood Purge continued all over Germany as Nazi leaders got rid of their most hated enemies, as well as the inevitable, quote-unquote, mistakes. Guard. Well, here's Davidson coming up. Ernst Röhm wasn't shot because the Nazi party felt outraged by the abrupt discovery that he was, quote, having his stormtroopers. That had been known for ages, but because of his sway over the SA had become a menace to Hitler. In the Hitler Youth, that dear love of comrades, unquote, was evilly turned into a political end. And if the Nazi hierarchy was well larded with homosexuals, so was William II's court, and so was the Weimar Republic. That's from Davidson, who's a historian I don't know, but he's saying that all these things are shot through with homos. And it was politics rather than disgust with homosexuality that led to the purge. And one final historian is Crompton. Hitler himself had been well aware of Rome's sexual orientation from the earliest days of their long association. So strong was Rome that the Wehrmacht, German Army High Command, was concerned he might seize control of the army. And remember, the SA is much bigger than the army. In 1934, Hitler became fearful that the Wehrmacht was plotting a coup against him to prevent such a takeover. To forestall this danger, Hitler had Rome and about 1,000 other men murdered one weekend in June 1934, the famous Night of the Long Knives. I didn't realize there were 1,000 killed. Igra, who's, I believe, a Jew historian, provides us with a long and detailed account of the power struggle which led to the purge, beginning with a refutation of the idea that it represented a policy of extermination of homosexuals by Hitler. Jew historian Igra, I believe he's a Jew, or he is a Jew, according to Lively. He says, we shall find that, far from eliminating the sex perverts from the party, Hitler retained most of them, and that he moved against those whom he did eliminate only with the greatest reluctance and after he had been relentlessly pushed by outside forces and circumstances. On June 14 and 15, Hitler was in Venice to see Mussolini. It soon became common knowledge that the German dictator and his entourage had made an unfavorable impression upon the Italians. Mussolini was never a stickler for Puritan morality, to say the least, but there was one vice which the Italians particularly loathed. They call it il vizio tedesco, the German vice. The conduct of some members in Hitler's entourage at Venice disgusted the Italians. Mussolini protested against the moral character and the political unreliability of the leading personnel in the Nazi stormtroops and warned Hitler that he would have to sacrifice his favorite colleagues if he wished to save his own personal prestige and that of his regime. Among these colleagues, Rome, Heines, and Karl Ernst were mentioned. The Rome purge, then, this is Lively again, was not a moral cleansing of the Nazi ranks, but a realignment of the power behind the German government, which was primarily forced upon Hitler by powerful political elements whose support he needed to maintain control. Igra goes on to point out that not only did the majority of the SA homosexuals survive the purge, but the massacre was largely implemented by homosexuals. He cites Strasser's statement that the chief killers of Munich were Wagner, Esser, Maurice, Weber, and Buch. These men were all known to be sex perverts or sexual maniacs of one type or another, concludes Igra. So you have a Jew who's asserting that the people who carried out the Night of the Long Knives were Jews themselves, were homosexuals themselves, killing other homosexuals. And Plant records a larger campaign of assassinations across Germany was orchestrated by Reinhard Heydrich, another also well-known homosexual. He's citing Plant. Now, I've never seen it said that Reinhard Heydrich was a homosexual, and I've never seen any proof of it. But the Jew is asserting it. Now, let's see. Now, so that's the Night of the Long Lives, and let's talk a little about what it was like in the camps. Although homosexuals were never targeted for extermination, some were interned. Actual number of Pink Triangle prisoners was 5 to 15,000. That's another estimate from a Jew at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and a tiny fraction of the total camp population. Of these, an undetermined percentage were heterosexuals, falsely labeled as homosexuals. Homosexuals who died in the camp, mostly of disease and starvation. Oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting admission. We're a small fraction of less than 1% of homosexuals in Germany. So the Jews are more than willing to admit that there were very few actual homos in the camps, and the ones that died of disease and starvation. So, they say the same things about homos that revisionists say about Jews, which is that there are far fewer in prison than the Jews claim, that far fewer died, and that they didn't die by gassing. They died of disease and starvation. So, I guess the Jews are being revisionists, but won't be thrown in jail when it comes to talking about what happened to homosexuals in Hitler's Germany. And I think we talked about a little of this last time. The American connection. let's see, while the Nazi Party was crushed as a political force in 1945, remnants of Nazism survive around the world. As in Germany, many of these fascist groups are dominated by male homosexuals. The most famous incident in the history of the American Nazi Party resulted from the 1977 demand to stage a march through the largely Jewish neighborhood of Skokie, Illinois, a Chicago suburb and the home of many Holocaust survivors. The plan was devised by Frank Collin, who often appeared with his followers in full Nazi regalia, brown shirts, black boots, and armbands. The march was blocked, but the ACLU backed Collins, and Chicago allowed it. The event drew international media attention. Homosexualists Johansson and Percy, in outing, shattering the conspiracy of silence, have finally revealed, more than 15 years later, that Collin was a homosexual pederast. He was also a Jew, though, which Lively doesn't mention. In 1979, Collin was arrested for taking indecent liberties with boys between ages 10 and 14 and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. It's from a 1994 book. Again, though, the more significant thing would be he was a Jew pretending to be a Nazi. All right, now we'll go to their summation, which is the conclusion of this article, Learning from History. Sadly, the homosexual dimension of Nazi history is overlooked by many historians. As Duberman, Vicenus, and Chauncey have stated with the title to their gay studies text, the role of homosexuals and pederasts has been hidden from history. I guess that's the title of their book, Hidden from History. They, of course, imagine the influence of homosexuality to be positive. From the Judeo-Christian cultural context, however, the rise of homosexuality necessarily represents the diminution of biblical morality as a restraint on human passions. Consequently, where Judeo ideals decrease, violence and depravity increase. It was the pederast of the community of the special that was formed by the Butch fag faction in Germany around the turn of the century, 1900. It was the pederast of the community of the special who sponsored the revival of Hellenic pagan ideals in German society. These men were viciously anti-Jew and anti-Christian because of the injunctions against homosexuality inherent in the Judeo-Christian sexual ethic. Homosexualist Warren Johansson notes that Hans Blücher, one of the leading theoreticians of the community of the special, maintained that Judaism had suppressed the homosexual aspect of its culture with concomitant hypertrophy, or enlargement, of the family. Benedict Friedlander, in an essay for Der Eigene, titled, that is, The Special, as of the community of the special, magazine The Special, titled Seven Propositions, chose as his first proposition an attack on Christianity. The white race is becoming ever sicker under the curse of Christianity, which is foreign to it and mostly harmful, writes Friedlander. That is the genuinely bad Jewish influence, an opinion that has proven true, especially through the conditions in North America. That's Friedlander, who's probably a Jew, in Oosterhuis and Kennedy. For his part, Adolf Brand, who's the Butch side of the homos, it was his division that set up the community of the special, called Christianity barbarism, and it, quote, expressed his desire to fight beyond good and evil, not for the sake of the masses, since the happiness of the weak would result in a slave mentality, but for the human being who proclaimed himself a god and was not to be subdued by human laws and ethics. We should not forget Nietzsche, who called Christianity, quote, the lie of the millennia. Much has been made of the reported silence and, in some cases, complicity of the supposed Christian churches during the Third Reich, but few have noted the long period of biblical deconstruction that preceded the rise of Nazism, and fewer have still have chronicled the diabolical perversion of the German religious culture by the Nazis themselves. While the neo-pagans were busy attracting from without, liberal theologians undermined biblical authority from within the church. So the fags are coming out from the outside, the liberal authorities from within. The school of so-called higher criticism, which began in Germany, just like public schooling, and just like gay rights. And remember, Germany was shot through with Jews. Portrayed the miracles of God as myths, by implication making true believers, Jew and Christian alike, into fools. And since the Bible was no longer accepted as God's divine and inerrant guide, it could be ignored or reinterpreted.
By the time the Nazis came to power, Bible-believing Christians, the confessing church, were a small minority. As Grunberger asserts, Nazism itself was a pseudo-religion that competed, in a sense, with Christianity and Judaism. The schools were heavily targeted in order to de-Christianize the young. Mandatory prayer in schools was stopped in 1935, and from 1941 onwards, religious instruction was completely eliminated for all students over 14 years old. The Nazi Teachers Association actively discouraged its members from taking religious instruction, while at the same time many teachers of religious studies, who were all required to be licensed by the state, inculcated neo-paganism into their pupils during periods of religious instruction. Later teachers were outright prohibited from attending voluntary religion classes organized by the Catholic Church. From the early years, leading Nazis openly attacked Christianity. Joseph Goebbels declared that Christianity has infused our erotic attitudes with dishonesty. It is in this campaign against Judeo-Christian morality that we find the reason for the German people's acceptance of Nazism's most extreme atrocities, which themselves are myths. Their religious foundations had been systematically eroded over a period of decades by powerful social forces. By the time the Nazis came to power, German culture was spiritually bankrupt. Too often, historians have largely ignored the spiritual element of Nazi history, but if we look closely at Hitler's campaign of extermination of the Jews, it becomes clear that his ostensive racial motive obscures a deeper and more primal hatred of Jews as the people of God. That's just outright bullshit. That is not, in fact, the case at all. First of all, there was no campaign of extermination against Jews. That is an absolute lie. What there was progressive legal restriction against them and discrimination. There was overt discrimination against Jews. They were identified as the other, and they were restricted from activities left open or given wider scope to Aryan Germans, which is to say Germans. But there was no campaign extermination at all. The probable reason for Hitler's attack on Christianity was his perception that it alone had the moral authority to stop the Nazi movement. But Christians stumbled before the flood of evil. As Polyakov notes, when moral barriers collapsed under the impact of Nazi preaching, the same anti-Semitic movement that led to the slaughter of the Jews gave scope and license to an obscene revolt against God and the moral law. An open and implacable war was declared on the Christian tradition, which unleashed a frenzied and unavowed hatred of Christ and the Ten Commandments. I would say this is just simply wrong, because I read the SS manuals myself, and they don't preach any of this. At best, they were trying to gently drift Christians away from some of their greater insanity and toward Aryan doctrines of strength and courage. But they were not shitting on the church even as much as I do. There is no question that homosexuality figures prominently in the history of the Holocaust. As we have noted, the ideas for disposing of the Jews originated with Lanz von Liebenfels. The problem here is, again, they didn't dispose of the Jews. The Jews emigrated when they found themselves facing legal restrictions that made it impossible for them to carry on their chicanery and their cheating and their conniving, their Bear Stearns, you know, government bailouts. When they found that they couldn't do this in the New Germany, they left. Remember, there was no war. The Nazis came to power in 1933. The war didn't start until 1939. And the war wasn't started by Germany. It was started by Britain and France attacking Germany. And there was no extermination of the Jews. They simply found conditions inhospitable and left. But here you have a Catholic, E. Michael Jones, allowing homosexuals and Jews to fill his magazine with things that are lies. Namely, that the Nazis exterminated the Jews. There was a campaign of extermination. Well, what kind of a campaign of extermination allows 90% of the Jews to emigrate before it begins? And that's exactly what happens. I've mentioned the diaries of Werner Klemperer as one Jew who is a professor in Germany right on through the whole war. Living there. I just got done. They threw him in jail for 8 days. Why did they throw him in jail? Well, he broke their blackout rules. You had the British bombers coming over and destroying German civilians in German cities for no reason. He broke the rules. They threw him in jail. They treated him friendly. They treated him nicely for 8 days. This is in the middle of a war. There was no extermination campaign. They knew who he was. His cards had J on them. He was labeled a Jew. They didn't round him up and kill him. So to say that there's an extermination campaign is a big lie, and Jones is allowing this lie to be spread in the pages of his own magazine. I don't think Jones has ever written about Ernst Sundell and any of the revisionists who were stuck in jail for telling the truth about what happened in Nazi Germany, because Jones perceives Nazism as a competitor to Catholicism. And he apparently takes advantage of the fact that the Jews he argues about in his pages, very forthrightly and factually and honestly, he takes advantage of the fact that those Jews have suppressed Nazism. Campaign of Extermination allows 90% of the Jews to emigrate before it begins. And that's exactly what happens. I've mentioned the diaries of Werner Klemperer as one Jew who is a professor in Germany right on through the whole war. Living there? I just got done. They threw him in jail for 8 days. Why did they throw him in jail? Well, he broke their blackout rules. You had the British bombers coming over and destroying German civilians in German cities for no reason. He broke the rules. They threw him in jail. They treated him friendly. They treated him nicely for 8 days. This is in the middle of a war. There was no extermination campaign. They knew who he was. His cards had J on them. He was labeled a Jew. They didn't round him up and kill him. So to say that there's an extermination campaign is a big lie, and Jones is allowing this lie to be spread in the pages of his own magazine. I don't think Jones has ever written about Ernst Sundell and any of the revisionists who were stuck in jail for telling the truth about what happened in Nazi Germany, because Jones perceives Nazism as a competitor to Catholicism. And he apparently takes advantage of the fact that the Jews he argues about in his pages, very forthrightly and factually and honestly, he takes advantage of the fact that those Jews have suppressed Nazism and uses it to get his religion ahead. So, the fact is, there's only one way to successfully fight and defeat the Jew, and that is through the biological approach that says, look, Jews and whites are two different subspecies. They don't get along. They don't mix. And the white must separate from the Jew to reclaim its own identity and to run its own lives and countries the way it finds best. And Jones doesn't want people seeing anything but Catholicism as a legitimate alternative to Zog and Zog's Ameriquois and the order that we have now. But in fact, there is another option, and that's what we are letting you know about. There's no question that homosexuality figures prominently in the history of the Holocaust. As we have noted, the ideas for disposing of the Jews originated with Lanz von Liebenfels. The first years of terrorism against the Jews were carried out by the homosexuals of the SA. The first concentration camp, as well as the system for training its brutal guards, was a work of Ernst Röhm. The first pogrom, Kristallnacht, was orchestrated in 1938 by the homosexual Reinhard Heydrich. Again, where's the proof that Heydrich was a homosexual? Now, he's a very significant personage. He's very well known. I've never seen it asserted that he was a homosexual. And it was the transvestite Göring who started the evolution of the final solution. I mean, that's like when they call, Giuliani a transvestite because he wore drag in some comedy skit. I mean, come on. That's an abuse of the term. And it was the transvestite Göring who started the evolution of the final solution with an order to Heydrich on January 24, 1939, concerning the solution of the Jewish question by emigration and evacuation. Well, now make up your minds, guys. Was there a campaign of extermination? Or was there a campaign of getting them to emigrate and evacuate? It can't be both at the same time. Still, despite their disproportionate role, homosexuals did not cause the Holocaust. They, along with so many others who had lost their moral bearings, were merely the instruments in its enactment. The Holocaust must be blamed on the one whom the Bible compares to a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. I don't know what that means. Yet while we cannot say that homosexuals caused the Holocaust, we must not ignore their central role in Nazism. To the myth of the Pink Triangle, the notion that all homosexuals in Germany, Nazi Germany, were persecuted, we must respond with the reality of the Pink Swastika. And that's their conclusion. And this is all at vienainform.com in the History and Religion forum, in the Nazis, the Facts subforum, in the Nazis, Homos, and Catholics thread. So What conclusion can we draw from this? Well, the conclusion we can draw is that there was some degree of homosexual involvement in the Nazi Party and in its founding and among its leading members, but that this is true of virtually all political movements because homos have time and money to spend and they're inherently conspiratorial, it seems to me can hardly be denied. We had the pedo-homo ring in the Bush and Reagan administrations that was subject of a banner headline in the Washington Times back when I was out there in D.C., back in like 92. I've linked to that in the Nazi thread just by comparison. But was the Nazi movement characterized by homosexuality? Were homosexuals the main or leading factor in it? I think that goes too far. And my final judgment on this, at least until I obtain any better evidence, is that E. Michael Jones has departed from the facts. He is allowing Jews and homosexuals, or he is allowing Jews and Catholics to... What's the right way to put this? Jones seems to be making an exception from his normal rules for evidence when it comes to the Nazis, probably because he sees them as a competitor to his Catholics. That's what I'm going to guess. Because he allows an awful lot of unsubstantiated allegations against the Nazis that he would never allow against the Catholics if it came from the same kind of sleazy Jews that Lively is using to quote from in the pink swastika. So one standard for critics of Catholicism and another standard for critics of Nazis for E. Michael Jones, as best I can tell, being very imperfectly educated on these matters, but very able to spot agendas. So let's leave it at there right now. We've gone, almost about 3 hours today, and I think that's enough for me. And as always, these shows are archived. We encourage your support, whether financial donations. You can find the address at govnn.com, top right. We encourage you to add your strength to ours, as William Pierce liked to say, in whatever form that is. Donations, one thing. We always need technical help. We always need people who know how to run. What I could really use is somebody who truly knows how to run vBulletin, how to optimize it so that we get quick page loading, and also someone who knows how to run servers. We face a near continual need for that. And I also want to mention, I'll spend a few minutes, just a couple more concluding minutes here on the what's new at VNN. We're also doing we're picking up our paper again so we can use writers and layout guys. Tony's volunteered to do layout. The fellow who did, I think it was Joseph who did the last newspaper that was done, which I had no involvement with, did an excellent job, far better than I did in laying out the White Patriot Leader. We're pulling all that together. We've got a thread in at vnnforum.com. We encourage you to join if you're a newcomer. Join vnnforum.com and participate in our activities as we put together a white head to lead the white body politic to freedom. Right? You understand what's going on here? All of this is revolutionary activity. That's why we spend so much time talking about homeschooling and ways to get out of the system. It's not working for us. In fact, it's aimed directly against us. And that's why we discuss other radicals in other times, such as the Nazis. Doesn't mean we ourselves are Nazis or believe everything they said. We don't get caught up in the labels. We look at what people actually did and believed and how they actually behaved and attempt to ferret that out and discuss it here in our radio shows. All of these shows are archived within hours of their conclusion, and I give credit to, I think it's Uber Saxon and Gibson who are working on that, and they're doing an excellent job. We encourage you to take the URL of these and spread them around. If you go to VNN Forum and you go to the subsection called VNN Broadcasting, you will find this show, Radio Astina, and all of our other shows, and you'll find that they each have archives created that list all the shows where you find all the show notes and the links to the articles that have been discussed in that particular issue. And you'll find these master archive of our panel show, Goy Fire, All of our 54 episodes of Goyfire are there recorded. You can listen to those. They're great. You put them in your MP3 player if you're on a long road trip this summer. Listen to them. They make the hours and the miles just fly by. You can listen to all these Radio Stinas, which are typically 2 to 4 hours in length. And this is about, I think this is the 16th one I've done. And I'll do another one in a couple more days. I try to do 2 a week. Maybe more in the future, but some preparation is involved. What we've just got done doing in the last couple of weeks is building up all the archives so that all of these shows are available in the broadcasting section. And you just go to the thread and you can get all the notes as well as the MP3 archive download. And we encourage you heartily to spread these around, let newcomers in. You know, we're trying to keep it nice and clean, even though it discusses some pretty dirty topics. And really bring people in and give them an alternative to the junk that they see on Jew-produced TV. It's getting people infected and infecting their brain with a bunch of lies. This is the way we build a media that goes around what the Jews are, alternative structures to the MSM and the Jew-controlled public schools. So let me leave it there for today, and this is March 19th, 2008. I'm going to play a couple more songs, and then we'll wrap it up at about 5:30, so we've been going just about 3 hours. I played a little Deer Tick today. If you like them, and there's a video on the archive for the last show of their song, Ashamed. But what do we want to play? I'll play a jumped-up version of Furlies by Beethoven, and then we'll play two more after that, and that'll do it. So here's Furlies by Beethoven. that'll wrap up Radio Estina for March 19th, 2008. Thank you for listening. I'm Alex Linder, and I am out of here.